Ladies and gentlemen, welcome and thank you for joining today's web conference, the Regional Resource Adequacy Stakeholder Working Group. Well, then, I'm going to turn things over to Tom Kusha. Tom, please go ahead.
Hello, everybody, and welcome again to the Regional Resource Adequacy. Our working group meetings are a little looser in format than our traditional stakeholder meetings. It's really there, it's really set up this way to have more open dialogue with one another, a lot of conversation back and forth. For the folks here in the room, for the benefit of the folks on the phone, as you are speaking, if you could remember to please state your name and the company that you represent, that helps the folks on the phone understand the perspective and where you're coming from or the type of questions you may be asking. And also, it helps if they need to follow back up with you if they have further questions. Today's topic or the discussion is going to be focused on reliability assessment, which is one of the topics included in the second revised straw proposal. We held similar working group meetings in June and July, and on the, one on local forecasting and the other one on the second resources and uniform counting rules. So today's proposal is going to be discussed in a little bit more depth. We have a full agenda here today. We are scheduled to go to 4 o'clock. We plan on taking a one-hour lunch from about 12 to 1. But, again, it's a little looser format today, so we'll squeeze it in. We really want to make sure that we have ample participation with the folks on the I'll always try to start with taking the questions from the folks in the room and then from there taking questions from the folks on the phone. And we know that sometimes dialogue needs to take place back and forth with the folks on the phone, so it is important that we do use the microphones at our desk. To use the microphones, just press once and let go, and it'll light up, and then you'll know that you have a live mic. When you are done speaking, please turn it off. We have a limit of about 3 or 4 old backers. We want to make sure that the folks on the phone can hear appropriately. And before we get started, Keith Johnson would like to kind of address the group as well as kind of take us through some background. So, Keith?
Okay, thanks, Tom. Good morning. This is Keith Johnson of the California ISO. For those in the room and on the phone, I did want to touch on, you know, there's been some recent developments about kind of the timing of all of this and the initiatives that we're working on that are related to expanding the balancing authority area. The ISO issued a market notice earlier this week. So I just wanted to take a minute to kind of, you know, brief you on kind of our latest thinking as of today. As you know, this is a pretty dynamic environment that we're working in. Things are moving you know, quickly. We've got a bunch of different initiatives going on. But I wanted to at least share with you to try to put it in perspective so you could get a feel for what so I guess I would start with by saying that the ISO is going to be taking additional time to develop the various things that we've been talking about with stakeholders, you know, really the concepts around the items for expanding our balancing authority area. And so, for example, you know, the big ones that you folks are well aware of, this would include governance, regional resource adequacy, the transmission access charge, and then also a topic that's of considerable interest to folks, greenhouse gases. So we are going to be taking additional time on those. Our goal is to continue to work with stakeholders on those various items that I've just mentioned with a goal of really developing the concepts more fully than they are today and to get them well developed, perhaps by the end of this year, but certainly in the first quarter of next year of 2017. So that's kind of the overall game plan. And as you know, some of these developments are fairly new, and so the ISO is in the process now of assessing where we're at, what might the schedules look like for these various activities that we're doing, and what the timeline might be. So, you know, more information. I did want to just touch on the four items just to kind of bring us up to speed on those for in case some of you are not as, you know, following all four of them perhaps. So I wanted to talk a little bit about them. So we have these four initiatives that I'd mentioned, regional resource adequacy, transmission access charge, governance, and then greenhouse gases. So we do have four different ISO teams that are working on those, staffed by different folks. but I want to assure you that we are all coordinating on those. We're collaborating, and so we're working together on those so that we're developing them in a manner. As far as what's going on so far, we're very actively engaged in the TAC discussions with folks, as you know. We have a working group on that tomorrow. I encourage you to ask questions there as well. We have the regional RA workshop today. That's the third workshop that we've had in recent months about regional RA. There's a lot of activity going on in governance, as you know. And then the other item that we will be starting in the coming weeks is a greenhouse gas initiative. We're thinking at the time that that'll probably kick off with the posting of an issue paper. So that is coming soon. So I wanted to share with you just as a final thing about regional resource adequacy, and you know, our team here is prepared to talk to you about that and plans going forward, and you know, we're obviously much more familiar with that. So I wanted to at least tell you what our current thinking is on that. We're having our working group meeting today. This would be our third working group. We've covered in the other working groups some of the other major elements of the scope of regional resource adequacy that far what we want to do is to have a good discussion with you here today. There will be future events. There'll be other papers going forward. So, you know, we are not moving forward, for example, at one point, like we might go to the Board of Governors. That's not happening, so that's not on the horizon. So I just wanted to clarify that for you. What we are asking here is we're going to have a hopefully a very good discussion today. We ask for your written comments, and then the ISO team, after we receive the written comments, will sit down and assess the comments that we've received on all of the working group material, and then we'll think about what makes sense going forward from there. Don't know whether it, at this point whether it would be another working group meeting, could be, or meetings. We might go more into phase where maybe we're writing stuff up more for people to digest and specifically comment on. But what I would say is, you know, stay tuned for that. But that's really where we've been and where we're going, in particular on regional RA.
All right, folks, and before we move forward with the presentation, what we'd like to do is go around the room and introduce each of the folks. If you could introduce yourself and the company that you represent. There are quite a few folks on the phone. We have about 70 people there, and there's about 25 people here in the room. So if we could start, we will start with you.
Can you hear me? Virginia Thompson, California ISO.
Deb Emerson with Sonoma Clean Power.
Meredith Youngheim with the California Public Utilities Commission.
Mark Huffman with PG&E.
Matt LaCar with PG&E.
Alan Wecker, PG&E.
Peter Ashcroft, Utah Office of Energy Development.
Nora Sheriff for CLECA.
Justin Boone, Southern California Edison.
Paul Nelson, Southern California Edison.
Mark Smith, Calpine.
Bob Heller, Dawson from FERC.
Sarah Kozel, Western Energy and Water.
Noah Tong, SDG&E.
Julian Beidler, Northern California Power Agency.
Kelsey Brown with PacifiCorp.
Mohammed Ola with CDWR.
Mohammed Ali, ISO.
Gautam Kata, ISO.
Saeed Farokay, FERC staff.
Marisha Balk, ISO.
Amelia Blanke, DMM, ISO.
Yeah, Kyle Hoffman, representing PowerX. Phil Bettengill, ISO.
David Zlotlow, ISO.
Again, Tom Kusha, I'll be facilitating today.
Carl Meuson from the ISO.
All right, thanks everyone. And I am Chris Devin, lead on this initiative. So I'm going to walk through the reliability assessment discussion and examples today with everyone. And I just wanted to welcome everybody and say thanks for coming. We appreciate everyone joining us today. And if anyone has questions on the phone, again, feel free to jump in. Hit your what is it? Star #2, #2 if you want to make a comment from the phone. And feel free to jump in at any point if you guys have discussion or questions about what we're talking about here. I think this should be try to be an open discussion on all this stuff. So again, the purpose of today is to facilitate understanding and how this actual reliability assessment mechanism will work and under the regional RA provisions. We want to go through some examples so people understand what we're talking about, because previously we've been talking at a higher level, so we wanted to get into a little bit of the details for you. Again, it's supposed to be a dialogue, so I think we're open to input. If people have issues or they see problems with this, that this is a good chance to raise those, so that way we can understand what everyone's thinking. And again, it should be educational. If you don't understand something, we have some of the folks here that do the assessment in the back of the room, Gotham and Abdul, and Carl's very familiar with it as well. So I think if we need any clarification, please let us know. Okay, so first off, I just wanted to go over kind of the fact that we have this year ahead process that we do and how that would work. And so this is just, again, to kind of a timeline to demonstrate that year ahead process and how we move into the month ahead reliability assessment. So the point of this is just to try to show folks that we have this posting of the megawatt values of resources, and then a period when LSCs have a chance to do their procurement after we have identified the needs or the capacity requirements that we have for each of those LSCs, and then when we actually do the showing. So it starts off in around the May, June timeframe, and that's when we will post the results of our counting rules and deliverability assessment. Then LSCs have a chance to go out and do procurement through May and June, July, August, September timeframe, and then we get to October, and the year ahead showings will be due. Then we do a validation then and make sure everything's working with the year ahead process, and all those plans and supply plans and RA plans get validated. And then we move into the essentially the month ahead process when we get into T-45 from the start of the operating year. So the other kind of timeline slides that I have throughout this presentation are just going to be about the month ahead assessment, because we're going to really focus on the month ahead process and how that will actually work. But I just wanted to put this up there so folks have an idea of kind of how it would work in that year ahead time frame. So once we flow into that, then we would be doing this month ahead reliability assessment. So what are some of the inputs and data, reference data that we use for the reliability assessment? So the main three things: system, local, and flexible capacity requirements. To come up with our system requirement for the LSEs, we would use their load forecasting, the PRM requirement, and then the resource capacity values that are shown by LSEs on their plans, and the along with the maximum import capability allocations that need to be shown for any import resources. So those are some of the things we look at in the system assessment, and then similar types of inputs go into the local and flexible, but those are slightly different. How would we do this reliability assessment? We're talking about for system and flexible, we do a cumulative system-wide assessment, make sure that we're overall sufficient in a cumulative sense. So we have enough provided by all LSCs to meet the total load across the system for system and flex. And then in the local requirements, we do that by attack area assessment. That's a current process, and we're not really intending to change that at all going forward. But that is kind of how we do it today. We look and make sure that enough local requirements are procured by each TAC area and those local areas. So we also are going to continue to do this cross-validation of RA and supply plans to make sure that there aren't any errors between what LSEs have shown us and what the scheduling coordinator for the suppliers are showing. Those resources have actually been made available by those suppliers. So here is the month ahead time frame that we're talking about, and I just wanted to give folks a little bit of an idea of the time frames that they have and when things happen. So I'm going to walk through the slide, and then I'll stop, and you know, people can ask some questions here. I think that would be a good opportunity to pause. So at T-minus 45, that's when the RA and supply plans are due. So we receive those, and that's all done through the CIRA application that we have. And then we take 3 days to do the validation, and so we're making sure that those RA and supply plans all match up. And then we get to T-minus 42. And that's when we provide the results of those validations to the LRAs, the LSEs, and suppliers. Noah, did you have a question? Okay. So at T-minus 42, folks would know if they have had their supply plans and RA plans validated, or if there was any errors or discrepancies in those that needed to be adjusted or fixed. So that's the essentially the first cure time frame. So you know, if somebody was short of their requirement, they would know at T-minus 42, and then you have approximately 12 days before we revalidate, essentially. But during that time frame, CIRA is going to be able to tell you every day if you update it. At least, that's right, Gotham, right? Okay, yeah. So you know, our process where everyone is updating these plans will actually tell you every day if you have, you know, met your requirements and it's validated. So it's kind of a constantly moving process, but you're allowed to be updating that anytime you need to as well. So that's the kind of the first opportunity to cure any deficiencies here in that T-minus 42 to T-minus 30 time frame. Question?
Hi, Deb, it's Nama Clean Power. Are you taking away the T-minus 11? I don't see that in your time frame.
Okay, so, yeah, so I am focusing here on this month-ahead reliability assessment time frame, which is, you know, the just T-minus 45 to T-minus 25. So all this process here that is, you know, the T-minus 20 to T-plus 31 is kind of the substitution, outage, and the supplier replacement process. And so we're not intending to change how that process works under this initiative at all. So that's why I was just trying to focus on how would the mechanism work for the reliability assessment piece. So yeah, none of those other time frames are going away. I just kind of omitted that stuff from this slide because this gets really busy if you try to put in all that stuff. But thank you for the question. So, okay.
Thank
go
you.
Ahead.
Sorry.
Meredith.
From the CPC. Comment and a question. Just wanted to note that this timeline does not work out this way every month and or rarely. So, you know, this seems pretty ambitious, and I also wanted to ask how this timeline compares to the current CPM timeline, because I don't remember the T-minus 25 as being an ISO decision on backstop of a quote-unquote final deficiency. I thought the cure period goes up to almost, you know, T-minus 1 currently.
Well, I'm going to look to Gotham to see if he can respond to that.
Yeah. So this is a little different from the current timeline. The current timeline goes all the way up to T-minus 11. So this timeline is part of the reliability services initiative that we changed, which is not in effect as of now. It's going to go live next year, fall of next year. So by T-minus 25, the idea is that all the LSEs will be done, curing any deficiencies, resubmitting their RA plans. And then after T-minus 25, we're going to get into the outage analysis. I think that's what Chris is trying to show here. And also with respect to T-minus 11, that's no longer going to be a cutoff date. It's just for the suppliers to submit all their substitute capacity they have up until T-minus 8 for the planned outages. So the idea is the RA showings should be final by T-minus 25.
All right, you're saying that that's under the RSI tariff amendment?
Yeah.
So the RSI amended this section of the tariff that talks about timing, and then the CPM filing also amended the section of the tariff about the CPM. I don't remember.
No, this is going to be part of the RSI Phase 1B.
But yeah. I'm saying this tariff, the tariff language to get rid of T-minus 11 and move it up to T-minus 25 was already approved by FERC? No.
No, we've drafted the and stakeholdered the I'm sorry, this is Carl from the ISO. We've drafted and stakeholdered the RSI 1B tariff language, and so that's basically been through the iterations, received I would say glowing reviews from the stakeholders that commented on it as far as what it was, and we're preparing that for FERC filing. I think the timeline on that is not yet perfectly evident, but as Gotham said, we're looking to have that implemented by fall of 2017.
Okay, so you're saying that the T-11 timeline was in the final RSI proposal that was approved by your board that was like almost 2 years ago or a year and a half ago, but you didn't file it as a complete tariff amendment package. You split it up, and so half of them haven't gone to FERC yet. You're going to be filing that at
soon.
Some point in the future.
Yeah, sometime
but,
in the near future.
Your final stakeholder proposal that your board approved talked about this T-11?
It did.
Okay.
And this is Keith. Let me just clarify. So RSI 1 was approved by our board. We split it into two pieces due to the implementation dates. RSI 1A is currently under testing with the market participants. It's been under simulation and testing for a number of months. It's scheduled to go live on November 1. Okay, phase 1B has a later implementation date, and we've been working internally to make sure that we know that that's an implementation date that we can live with and make. We haven't made the filing at FERC yet because although the tariff provisions and the policy has been approved by our board and the tariff language has been run through a stakeholder process and agreed upon by the ISO and is ready to file soon at FERC, we're not filing it too early because FERC would like us to file tariff language not super far in advance of implementation dates, and so we've been holding on to the tariff language, which is why you have not yet seen the tariff filing to FERC for phase 1B.
All right, so thanks for all the clarification,
Meredith,
guys.
One final point. This is David. The RSI 1B language is on our website under the stakeholder page. And that was stakeholdered a few months ago. So if you want to see that, it is on our website. And so I think the timeline here, because this is an initiative that's assumed to be implemented sometime in the next several years, I think, you know, that this is timeline is written on the assumption that RSI 1B, we're talking about fall 2017 is the likely implementation date, that this initiative, the regional RA, will be implemented sometime after that has been filed with FERC approved. So that's just an assumption about the timing, but that you're correct, that has not been filed with FERC and approved, but you can see
and
that
I think
language.
That's
like.
What's confusing, because usually when you guys talk about implementation, you're implementing tariff language that's already approved, that's already been filed, and not using it to discuss, like, your, you know, drafting
well,
pre-filing process.
Yeah, I think, as Keith said at the outset, we're dealing with multiple contingencies in terms of the different initiatives here. Yeah.
Yeah, so I'll just say this is the timeline that we hope to have in place, and that's what we're trying to get to. And so just work with me on this, and just imagine that it will all be T-minus 45 to T-minus 25 when we get to the time frames for regional RA. Okay, thank you, guys. So to keep walking through it. So then we get from this monthly CPM assessment starts at T-minus 30. So the ISO is doing this assessment and looking and seeing what the potential deficiencies are, and that this is another chance LSEs will know at that point. Again, after they had that first opportunity to cure, and the ISO is revalidating every day and providing that result through CIRA, that they will need to do remaining deficiency would need to be cured during this time frame. So that's the last chance for curing. Then we would make a decision if there was any final deficiency that was still remaining after all that cure was done. We would make a decision if there was a need for a backfill. Then we're talking about the rest of the process that I had mentioned earlier, is the supplier replacement and all that. We're not trying to change any of that. So then we get into the operating month and the assessment, the reliability assessment piece is essentially done at that T-25 time frame. Okay, so let's talk about the different showings a little bit. So these are kind of just some background slides for folks. We provided this way back when we first started this initiative, kind of as a little background piece on overall RA, but I just wanted to go through it again because this is what's related to this validation and how we've actually been doing it and, you know, what Gotham and Abdul see when they're looking at this validation. So all the LSEs, they have to provide these RA plans that demonstrates what resources have been secured for RA by each LSE to meet their requirements. Then the ISO validates those plans against the NQC list and the supply plans. And we use this sort of a template right here, and that's uploaded through CIRA. And this is just an example one that we used, you know, for purposes for people to see what it looks like in the tool itself. So what do we do when we validate those showings? We, you know, we make sure that the resource ID exists, it's spelled right, there's no errors there. We make sure that the megawatt value is entered, you know, greater than zero, up to two decimal places. They have a start date and an end date, and all the appropriate fields are filled in. And then, you know, we're proposing that we would, under this process, we would use the uniform counting rules values to do the validation. And then that's kind of some of the examples that I'll walk through of how that will work. So on the supply side, the supply plans, suppliers demonstrate what resources were made available to what LSEs, and then committing those resources to the ISO, subject to the must-offer obligation and any of those performance incentives that we have. So it really essentially is just a check to make sure that the LSEs that said, you know, what capacity has been committed matches up with what the suppliers are saying they've sold that capacity to the particular LSEs. And then, again, they upload this template through CIRA, and this is just another example of that, similar to the RA plan. So why do we really need these? Again, it demonstrates what resources have been secured for meeting the requirements. If we didn't have these plans submitted, we wouldn't be able to verify that individual LSEs have met the requirement. And the supply plan actually confirms that scheduling coordinator is committed to schedule and bid those resources into the ISO, so they have that must-offer obligation and they'll be available. It establishes a formal business commitment between the ISO and confirms as committed capacity. Okay, so where are we at in the process now? This is kind of where we are, right? What we're going to be talking about when we're doing the validation of these RA and supply plans in this T-minus 45 to T-minus 30 time frame. So what do we do? So we look, oh, sorry. So I think I moved that slide in the wrong order. Sorry. This is, again, similar to that one on the RA plan. We make sure that the resource ID belongs to the right scheduling coordinator and that the megawatt idea for that particular resource ID actually is less than or equal to the deliverable capacity of the resource, and then the start date and end date is entered. So when we're in that T-minus 45 time frame, after we have them submitted, we do this cross-validation. So that's the first thing we do. We make sure that the LSE records are matching up with the supplier records and there's no basic errors or warning, and then we make sure that everyone is informed of what the outcome of that was, and any of the error-free capacity is committed as RA capacity. Okay, so how is this going to work with the uniform counting rules? This is really what I want to talk through with everyone and what our, you know, vision for how this would work, and so that everyone kind of has an idea of this mechanism and how we would use the capacity values that are determined under this uniform counting rules proposal for regional RA. So we are proposing that we would calculate those uniform counting rule values for the individual resources in advance of the procurement timeframe and post that, similar to what we do today with the NQC list. Again, it would be those uniform counting rules and the deliverability that was done for each of the individual resources. And then during this assessment, we will just confirm that the total megawatt value of the resource does not exceed the resource's deliverable megawatt capacity value determined through that counting rules process. Okay, so let's get into some examples now. Meredith, go ahead.
Sorry, could you go back to slide 13, the timeline? So essentially what you have here is a So between 30 and 25, you have ISO assessing need for backstop. So where is the cure period? I mean, where is the, you're assessing the need on T30, between T30 and T25, but then you're also making a final decision where
ISOs
have an opportunity to go procure more.
Right, so at T-minus 30 is when we would they would have had a 12-day period there to be updating their plans, and then my understanding of how CIRA works is every day that you upload something, it will update that. It will say, okay, you provided another 100 megawatts of capacity and changed your plan to show that, and you were previously short 100 megawatts, and if you were showing that you were going to be deficient, then the next day it would, say, okay, everything's good, you validated, you're not going to be deficient. So that's why, we're assessing the need for CPM. As we go forward, people have that five-day time frame to go out and make arrangements and do other procurement. So it's kind of always going on. It's an ongoing process with CIRA validating, making sure that everyone is sufficient. So that's kind of the nuance there, but I can see how you would say there isn't really
But any individual LSC can be deficient, and that doesn't necessarily call for a CPM. So I think it needs to be very clear when the point is that you're absolutely going to decide whether or not you're having a CPM.
At that T-minus 25, where it says decision on final backstop.
Between T-minus 42, LSEs may know whether or not they're deficient, but we don't know whether the system requires a CPM until the same day that it's too late to fix anything else.
Overall, I think, that's the process, but you would know if you were individually short from your requirement during that entire time frame.
But you can't CPM for individual shortages, so.
Right, and we're not saying that we would CPM for individual shortages. We would only CPM if there was a system-wide, cumulative deficiency. So, the picture isn't all the way finalized until we get through that cure period, because we don't know if we're going to have a system-wide deficiency until everyone has updated those plans, made sure that, they procured up to what they need to procure, and then that's when the ISO will, be able to see the final picture and make the decision.
That might be as little as 5 days.
So there should be, there's a 12-day period in the beginning once you know if you're short or not, and then you have 12 days to do adjustments to your plans, and then, that's when we would start that CPM assessment where we're looking at the big picture, and that's going on at the same time that you have another 5 days to look, the LSEs would have another 5 days to potentially cure and adjust their plans as well.
Seems like a significant departure from current practice, so I just wanted to highlight that.
Okay, I'm trying to work under the assumption that the tariff language that we're going to have in place from other initiatives is going to be kind of governing this time frame. Okay. So, sure.
Justin Boone from Southern California Edison. What was the driver or drivers for moving this timeline up from the T11 to T25 time frame?
I'm not familiar with that effort, but I'm going to turn it over to Gotham in the back there.
The outlet substitution. So because right now we have both the LSE and supplier involved in it, and it's a big mess, so we want to decouple the two, and then that's why we want to finalize the RA showings by T25, so it gives enough time for suppliers to substitute for any planned outages.
Thanks, Gotham. Okay, so let's get into some examples and try to talk through these a little bit. So we're going to start off simple and then try to get into some more nuanced examples and try to explain the mechanism. And so, jump in if you don't understand where I'm going on the example or I'm not, saying it clearly and you need some more clarification, just let me know. So for example one, this is the simple one where we just have one LSE and one supplier, and they're going to, everything's going to work out fine if they, both provide the same numbers on their plans and everybody's happy, right? So, again, the uniform counting rule value for our resource ID, Mighty Wind 1, is 100 megawatts. And so that resource owner is saying that they've sold 100 megawatts of capacity from that resource. So the LSC will claim 100 megawatts on their RA plan. And then on the showing for the supply plan, the scheduling coordinator will identify that LSC 1 has procured 100 megawatts, So when we do the validation, we'll say, okay, does the megawatt value from the LSE showing match what the owner of the resource showed on the supply plan? Yes, it does. And then so we look and say, okay, does it exceed the actual uniform counting rules capacity value? And it doesn't. So, you know, 100 does not exceed the 100 megawatts. So we validate the RA plan and supply plan, and that resource is then committed as RA capacity. So that one's kind of the most straightforward, you know, basic example I could provide, where it's just everything's good and we're validating that and move forward, that the ISO is good on that. Okay, so now here's a situation where we would see if someone were to exceed the deliverable uniform counting rules value. So again, one LSE, one supplier, the uniform counting rules value of Mighty Wind 1 is again 100 megawatts, the LSE is saying that they procured 130 megawatts of capacity from that resource. So they're saying that their procurement on their RA plan is above what the uniform counting rules capacity value is. So on the showing, they're saying, okay, and there's a typo here, sorry. So this should be 130 under showings. But the scheduling coordinator is saying, for the supply plan side, is saying that they only sold 100 megawatts to the LSE. So when we do this validation, we would say, okay, does it equal the LSE equal what the resource suppliers showed, and then does it exceed the deliverable counting value, uniform counting rule value of the resource? And in this case, again, I have a typo here, but this this one should say 130, and this one is 100, so it would exceed that in this situation if we look back up here. But the intent of this one. I'm sorry for the typo there, but. Oh, I see. Okay, yeah. So sorry. This should be 130. We should be talking about 130 up here on this RA plan. But the intent of this example is just simply to show that the ISO would notify that there was a discrepancy in this process. You know, we would show an error that it didn't meet the requirement that the showing should not exceed the uniform counting rules megawatt capacity value. Okay, so another example here. This one is, again, one LSE, one supplier, but this is what happens when, and this is a kind of a special example when there's just one LSE and one supplier talking about this resource, and this is when the LSE is saying that they procured a certain amount of resource from the resource owner, and then the resource owner is actually saying that they only sold a lower amount of that capacity resource. So what happens right now in that situation is that, like for instance, in this example, the LSE is saying that they procured 100 megawatts of capacity from the resource, and then the supplier is saying that they actually only identified that they sold 80 megawatts on their supply plan to the LSE-1. So what happens? Well, the check on the deliverable uniform counting rules, that's okay because it doesn't exceed 100 megawatts that we said was the value for that uniform counting rules value. But the supplier has provided a lower number than the LSE. And when there's only this one supplier, one LSE situation, then the ISO would notify that the LSE and the resource owner that they should resolve this discrepancy. And if there isn't a change made during that adjustment time frame, then the ISO would use that 80 megawatts from the supply plan, and then the LSE could be deficient if they don't provide additional 20 megawatts. But that's kind of I would say limited circumstances this would happen. So it's only when there's one supplier, one LSE on the plan for that one particular resource where this would actually happen. But now we'll get into it where we have a couple supplier or a couple LSEs and using one capacity resource as one supplier. So this one is, I believe this one, yeah, works out fine. So example 4, we have the two LSEs, the one supplier, and Mighty Wind 1 is selling 100 megawatts of its resource. The LSEs say that they have procured 75 megawatts from LSE-1, and then LSE-2 says on their plan they got 25 megawatts. The showings for the supply plan says that they have sold 100 megawatts of that resource. So all those things all work out. We validate it. 100 megawatts doesn't exceed the deliverable counting value. and the ISO would validate the RA and supply plans, and then that resource would be committed as RA capacity. All right, so I guess I'll pause and see if anybody has any questions on these ones before I keep moving forward on the next examples. I think that's when we would reject a couple different examples there. Any questions about how these examples are working out? Is it clear to people kind of what would happen when we do this validation process? All right. Well, let's keep going then. So another example where we have two LSCs with one supplier, but this one I believe is, yeah, so this one is where there's an extra amount that the LSCs have claimed above and beyond what the uniform county rules value is. So again, same resource ID, 100 megawatts under the uniform county rules. The LSC1 has claimed that they have procured 75 megawatts. LSC2 says they procured 50 megawatts. So on the showings, and then the supply plan only says, hey, we only have 100 megawatts here that we have sold off to the LSCs. So what happens? Okay, we look and the check is done. It's been shown for 125 megawatts, but that exceeds the uniform counting rules value of 100 megawatts. So then the ISO would reject those supply RA and supply plans and notify those LSCs and the resource owner that they need to adjust their plans and coordinate. All right, so example six is a little bit different. This is when we have one that's, this is a little bit more complicated, so let me walk through this one slowly. Okay, so the uniform counting rules value, again, 100 megawatts from the resource. Each of the LSCs say that they have procured, one says they got 75 megawatts from LSC1 on their supply plan, and then LSC2 says they procured 25 megawatts. Now, the supply plan says that they only sold 50 megawatts to LSC1 and 25 megawatts to LSC2. Sorry, there's a typo here. This should say LSC2 right here. Folks, again, I apologize for that. So when we did the validation, we would say, okay, let's look at and see if the total sum of all those megawatts shown by the LSCs is less than the deliverable uniform counting values. And so we look at that check, we see that only 75 megawatts was shown, so that doesn't exceed that value, so that part passes. But the LSC1 showing, it does not actually equal what the resource owner and SC is showing on the supply plan, right? Because they said that they only sold 50 megawatts of that to LSC1. And they're claiming 75. The LSC is claiming 75. So what happens in this situation? The ISO would reject LSC1 showing because it wasn't equal to what the supplier showed that they committed for that LSC. Then the ISO would say, okay, LSC2, yours matches up and it doesn't cause any errors, so that one would be validated. And any of the corresponding submissions for that supply plan, that part of it would be validated. But then we would also notify the LSCs and the resource owner that there was a discrepancy and that they needed to make adjustments to their plan. If no adjustment was made, then the ISO would again use the supply plan and say that LSC1 has 50 megawatts of committed RA capacity, and then they could potentially be deficient 25 megawatts. All right, so those are all the examples that I have for how the validation process would work. Trying to keep it simple as possible and show some different scenarios. So I'll just open it up for any questions, comments. Go ahead, Keith.
So Keith Johnson here from the ISO. I just wanted to make sure we are clear. You know, this is some details of RA showing process that not all stakeholders may be very fluent in. So I just wanted to point out some things so that we could have a good discussion. A lot of what Chris has gone through here in these last examples is existing policy, if you will, existing provisions. Don't want folks to be alarmed or to think that it's a new construct, the concept where the ISO goes with the values in the supply plan. That's the way it's been for years. And I think Chris explained the reason for that is that we have the relationship with the SC for the generator. That's the entity that is fulfilling the must offer obligation, et cetera. we need to know that the supplier has committed capacity. So any of these examples where you say RA showing says X, but supplier plan says Y, absent a change, we go with what the supplier says. That's existing policy. That is not a change brought upon by regional resource adequacy, for example. The one big change here, if you really were to boil this down, is that we're suggesting using the uniform counting rule value as the cap megawatt value. So that's different, but I have to tell you that currently today there are caps, if you will, on what a resource ID is able to show as resource adequacy capacity. Today it's referred as the NQC value. And we do the same thing today. If a resource supplier sells pieces of their resource to multiple LSEs and the total is more than the NQC, we do the same thing today. We reject the showings. We ask them to work it out. If there's a discrepancy about who sold what to whom, they work it out. And when they have when the dust has settled, we end up going with what is submitted. And it's the supply plan that rules, but the RA showings then are adjusted. And so this notion, some folks may see here on the slide that, the LSE might be deficient on its RA showings is, again, I hope I'm being clear here, this concept of this validation and how this could occur in these scenarios we're describing exists today. The value that you're comparing against, this cap, is the NQC today, future would be the counting rule. So I just wanted to clarify, there's not a lot of new process here. It's really just one of the important metrics, which I think Chris is trying to get to, which is there's an assessment. Today we just call it an assessment. In the future we're calling it a reliability assessment, and a key feature of that is a cap, which would be the accounting value rule that we have published in advance of the RA year so folks know what that is. And in my mind, what's really important is the suppliers really need to know what that number is, because the suppliers are going to be held to that, so to speak. In other words, if people are contracting for more than that cap in total from a resource that you own and are making arrangements with LSEs, then that's going to be a problem when it comes to validation.
Yeah, so actually, thank you for that clarification. I think it's good to note that we kind of are talking about mostly stuff that we already do today, but then also, the intent of this is really to show how this uniform counting rules will be used in this process. So I've got a question for Noah and then Carrie.
Hi, Chris. Noah Thomas, DG&E. So in the event an LRA's counting convention that differs from the ISO but allows any resource to count for higher than what the ISO's NQC is. In this case, the ISO would limit the SC's showing to be that of the ISO's NQC. But if you go down one more step, the LRA would accept the higher number, right, for their LSC. If there's a deficiency in that case and the LRA finds that there's no deficiency for its LSC, what does the ISO do in the case of a CPM backstop and cost allocation?
Okay, so we're intending that this uniform counting value should be the maximum that is contracted for, so that kind of situation wouldn't occur. I think that's kind of the hope behind where we're going with this, so that we have the uniform counting rules providing that value ahead of time, as Keith had mentioned earlier, So folks know what the ISO believes that resources, reliability value is worth in a capacity sense. So do you want to add something to it, Kyle?
So to add on to Noah's point, though, I want to make sure we're fully understanding it first off, which is under today's current tariff provision, there's the rule that states if the LRA says, no, you're fine, then the backstop procurement costs, instead of going to the LSE, then get peanut buttered across the system. Is that where you're going to, Noah?
Yeah, I'm asking if we're talking about the current world.
Yeah.
And is the ISO talking about that current world in regionalization or after regionalization?
I think it's up for discussion. I think our initial kind of thinking on this is on a regional footprint basis. We're looking to have uniform rules for counting that apply to all LSEs regardless of their LRA and the determinations the LRAs make. So when we plug in the numbers that we'll be using here, these are to be used based on whatever the input numbers, and again, that's a very interesting and other discussion, whatever those input numbers are would be the basis for determining the deficiencies or adequacies of the showings relative to the uniform counting rules.
So are you saying that you're going to supersede the values that the LRA allows?
Yes, that's what they're saying, Noah.
I appreciate the input, Meredith. I think what we're saying is we're trying to apply a standard counting rule across all LRAs so that there's a uniform understanding and to really kind of mitigate some of the potential leanings of LRAs and to, again, have a consistent understanding of resources that are sold across LRAs about what the counting conventions are for those resources.
And then the cost allocations directly to that particular LSC that you find to be deficient?
Based on the uniform counting rules.
Okay.
Again, I want to be clear that this is a working group, and so this is a matter for discussion. If folks have input and feedback they'd like to provide, I'm shocked to see certain hands go flying into the air.
Okay, hold on, though. We're going to go to Carrie first before that. Sorry.
No, I had the same question as Noah.
Okay. So now, go ahead, Mary.
I mean, I think we've actually, many stakeholders have already provided this feedback that they've asked for deference to LRA counting conventions from the CAISO as much as possible and for the CAISO to only supersede LRA's counting conventions if absolutely necessary. And so that seemed to be the conversation we were having two working groups ago in Portland. There was language about being, deferential, and as many of you are probably aware, California statute actually says that the CPC has primary responsibility for resource adequacy for our regulated LSEs in California. So I think you're all highlighting the problem with not being deferential, but also that's why I was highlighting the timeline at the beginning, because I think that if there are discrepancies, we're going to need more than 12 days to talk about them and work them out, especially if they're significant.
Okay, I appreciate the comment. I think I would just provide the counter view that we have also heard from numerous stakeholders that they believe that uniform counting values are reasonable and required to maintain reliability and do this reliability assessment that we're actually proposing under this initiative. So go ahead, Carrie.
Carrie Bentley for WPTF. We're one of those stakeholders who support this. We feel that contracting is difficult enough in this environment, and it's hard for generators to sell to different LRAs and not know what their RA value is. If you then take that a step further and you have a regional market and you have even more LRAs, you're going to have separate contracts and separate ideas on what it may be worth. And then when you get to this step on, verifying the cure period and seeing if you may be CPM'd, often the contract is the supplier who's on the hook for that. So waiting until that last moment, if the supplier doesn't know what their capacity is worth and if they may be CPM'd or not, that's a really difficult position to be in. We fully support this. That caveat, though, we do think the cost allocation needs to be worked out, and we do need to know exactly when it'll be transferred from the obligation to the LRA down to the specific LSE. But we're pretty confident that that will be worked out.
Thanks, Gary. Yeah, go ahead, Keith.
Keith Johnson, California ISO. I just wanted to, in the interest of having a good discussion today, kind of put the two bookends of the discussion out there and not taking a position, if you will, one way or the other. So, one of the so what we're talking about here when we talk about accounting rules, and then Chris expressed it well, is there's some folks that think that it's really important to have standardized values for a number of reasons, one of them being reliability and, having values that you're comfortable you can operate the system to, and having that assessment done by one entity that is able to look at all the operational needs across the entire footprint, however big that footprint might be. That's one school of thought. Another school of thought is that expressed by some stakeholders that different areas of the grid, different entities should be able to establish counting rules, and that the ISO would not be establishing these standards. So those are kind of the two bookends. And I think we've talked a fair amount, and there's been a lot of discussion about what people may not agree with regarding establishing standards and why that might not be what they would like for various reasons or required for perhaps by various things that are, you know, set up at this time. But what we haven't heard a really good discussion about is, and I'll tee it up, and I apologize, I don't mean to be flippant or loose here, but you know, we haven't had a really good discussion about what the world would look like with a Wild West where everybody could establish their own counting rules. What would the ISO do? How would the ISO be able to maintain system reliability if many, many different entities could establish whatever the accounting rules were and then submit showings with whatever values? How would we operate in a world like that? So we're very interested in folks describing to us how that could work. At the moment, we're talking about these two different bookends, and I don't know whether we end up in the middle somewhere or what eventually, and we have a number of months to work this through, but I would encourage everyone to have a good discussion about that.
Yeah, thanks, Keith. I think that you know, that's a really good point. One of the things that we've heard is that people want us to have, you know, give them full deference to this, but we haven't really heard how that could really work when we have a lot of different entities providing different capacity values. We see that might cause some issues. So that's just kind of one of the things to talk about, you know, and I understand that some of the folks are you know, on both sides of the issue. I've heard, you know, various input from all, I'd say, of the full range of things. And then, you know, I would also just note that in my experience in other regional markets, they don't have this kind of deference to the local regulatory authority to set those counting rules. It's all set, you know, by the regional entity. You know, I think it's worked all right here because we've had the majority of the resources under one kind of counting convention under the CPUC, but when we expand regionally, we might see that there would be, you know, the potential for many entities that were creating different capacity values for resources based on their own counting rules. So we believe that seemed that could cause a lot of issues, and it would be very difficult for us to reliably assess the level of capacity that we have across the system. So with that, I'm going to move into the stuff about backstop and all that. Okay, and before that, we'll let Meredith.
Thank you. I have a suggestion.
Sure.
Potentially, you know, you could set uniform rules but only apply if, in fact, another state has adopted a rule that's inconsistent with California for that resource type. I mean, it's my understanding that right now there aren't any other states that are potentially joining the ISO that have adopted counting rules because they don't run an RA program the way that California does. So why couldn't there be deference to California unless there's a case of a actual discrepancy? Or you could defer to the counting rules of the state in which the resource itself is located if that state has adopted counting rules.
Nora?
Nora, Sheriff for CLECA, I would support that suggestion. I think it's a reasonable solution, and I would add that while California has generally been lucky in the fact that there haven't been significant disagreements or multiple disagreements over the counting rules, there is one instance where there has been a disagreement over the counting rules, and that's for demand response. And, you know, in the demand response community, we're still waiting for some resolution on that. And that is a significant issue. And CLEAC has asked that you address how would you deal with the discrepancy between the local regulatory authority and the CAISO. And we've not been satisfied with your response of, you know, sort of our way, my way, or the highway. So I like Meredith's solution.
Okay, so Kelsey and then Carrie.
Sorry. So I guess I would want to simply just address that a little bit.
Can you speak closer to the mic? Sorry.
I said with PacifiCorp. With regard to the other states that are surrounding California, they do have programs. I agree. It's not necessarily, it's not called
resource adequacy, but there's definitely programs in place where we go through and we do counting. We do a full stakeholder process ourselves at PacifiCorps, for example, with regard to our integrated resource planning process that our states definitely recognize. They recognize that in our qualifying facility filings, in our avoided cost filings. It's definitely something that is agreed upon by our states and acknowledged by our states in regulatory proceedings. So I don't know that I would be that dismissive about the work that is done in other states associated with counting.
I wasn't trying to be dismissive. I just know that they don't publish counting rules. The LRAs themselves don't, publish a set of NQC values, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what I was trying to say. I wasn't trying to be offensive or I apologize if that's how it came across.
Well, and they don't, and she's right. I mean, they don't necessarily say, okay, this is what we're going to adopt for you. They allow each utility to put forward, and again, it's through a consolidated process and through a stakeholder process that we have with each of our stakeholders within each of our states. And then the commission then chimes in and says, yes, we adopt that, or yes, we acknowledge that. Again, I think it comes down to just a little bit of a process difference, but I don't necessarily believe that it has any less significance or any less relevance to the same process that California goes through.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
So if we wanted to, for example, identify how a demand response resource is counted mm-hmm. in each of your states, is there an easy place we could go to find out how that calculation is done so that we could compare it? Or same thing for renewables? Same thing for hydro, for example. Is there an easy reference point?
There is.
Okay.
It's the integrated resource plan that we file in each of our states.
Okay. So each state's IRP has a section that explains all of that. So if we wanted to compare them side by side, we could take the California RA decision side by side with each state's IRP and look for discrepancies.
Each state's utility's IRP. So each utility files a separate IRP.
Right.
Right. Including gas facilities
right.
as well.
But the state of Oregon, which has mm-hmm. multiple utilities operating in it, doesn't publish a decision that says this is how hydro resources are counted in our state.
They acknowledge how the utility has counted the hydro resource for that state, and then they acknowledge then the action plan that's developed associated with how each utility has been approved to account for the resources, including demand response, because we do work very closely with we have a separate program in Oregon called Energy Trust of Oregon
yes.
that actually goes through, it does a full audit, and there is something on their website that talks about how we do count all of our demand response resources, class 1 through class 3. So there is a lot of literature out there that does discuss this in each of our states.
It's just not in a centralized place. Is that what we're saying?
I'm just trying to help, if we wanted to look at them side by side, I think to Chris.
It sounds like it was very central to me. You need to go on their website and find their IRP and look through it, and there's ones for each of the states and all that right on PacifiCorps' website.
For PacifiCorps in each of those states.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank
but
you.
We technically
okay.
only have two IOUs in Oregon. For example, Washington has three. So there's not that many utilities in each of the states. Utah has one. We are the only one in Utah. Wyoming, I think, has three. It's not that voluminous.
But thanks for the clarification, Kelsey. So I got a few people in the queue, and so Nora. So hold on. So first Carrie, then Mark, and then Nora.
Carrie Bentley with WPTF. I didn't want anyone to get the impression that California is that uniform. It's not like there's only one LRA in California, only one set of uniform rules, right? There's 26. Perry, I don't know, something like 26 different LRAs, and each of them are allowed their own counting rules. So it's not that centralized here either, not different in the PacifiCorps area. And I think that just highlights the challenge, right? I mean, yes, the CPUC is 80% of our capacity, but we do, and the ISO does have to accommodate all these other LRAs today, and that's already challenging. So I don't think the argument that it's centralized or it's easier is really a good one to say how should this Western ISO be designed going further.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think it would be hard for anyone to say how, all the different LRAs are counting unless they went through the process and looked and saw what their rules were. And, I doubt anybody knows all of them right now. This would be great. But I'm going to go to Mark first, then Norris.
Hi, it's Mark Smith at Calpine. I guess I have two points. One is that I think the ISO has a fundamental obligation to ensure the reliability of the grid, not only in near term, but allowing that resource adequacy is ensured over the long term. And so the ISO must have oversight of some kind on the counting rules. Otherwise, the political self-interest of an individual state may cause them to overcount certain kinds of resources. And the second point is that I would like to make is that even the PUC's rules are not uncontroversial. As a matter of fact, the counting of solar has been controversial for quite some time. The PUC is under statute to convert to an ELCC methodology, which to date they have refused. Well, I won't say refused. They have not accomplished yet. And so I think there's controversy in establishing those, and I do think that the ISO has an obligation to oversee the counting rules to ensure they're just and reasonable. Thanks.
Thanks, Mark. Nora?
Nora Sheriff for CLECA. I have a request and a comment. I would ask that PacifiCorp's comments, which are coming in, I think, on August 17th, along with everybody else's comments, if you could include a link, PacifiCorp, in your comments to where we can easily find all of the other counting rules that you were saying. It's not voluminous, not too hard to do. But if you could do that and have it in your comments, that would be really helpful. And then the comment is, you know, California state law is California state law, and the CAISO is supposed to work with the CPUC and defer to the CPUC in terms of setting the resource adequacy requirements. I don't know, out of the 26 local regulatory authorities that there are, I guess, that have different counting rules, how many of those are within the CAISO's current balancing area, but I do say that the all of them?
All of those.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay, okay.
So currently
okay,
we have
okay.
that many that have different rules
okay.
right now.
I don't know what the state law says about those counting rules, but I do know what it says about the CPC. So I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, and I think most of those other LRAs are probably not jurisdictional to the CPC, which is why they would, you know, have the authority to do those different rules right now under the current paradigm. But I'm going to turn it over to Kyle. He wants to add something.
So both Mark and Nora, I think, hit on a very interesting point as it pertains to the CPUC's efforts on ELCC and what ELCC is, and one of the challenges that we have with, and I think it points to one of the reasons why we've started kind of the discussion looking at the idea of a uniform counting rule. ELCC studies tend to be resource and portfolio specific. So when you're looking at what is your load mix, what is your resource mix, where is that located, that's very important to the outcome and the results of what the capacity values of some of those resources are. So it's one of the challenges we discussed last working group meeting about what the uniform counting rules would be looking at for the wind and solar resources. And we proposed a footprint-wide ELCC study methodology to determine that uniform counting rules for wind and solar resources. Now we know that, you know, as we've learned through the CPUC process, that ELCC studies are rarely, if ever, easy. We know that we've kind of got our pulse on what many of the challenges are, thanks to the hard work and dedication of Donald Brooks and the folks down there. So, you know, let's give credit where credit's due. But again, the numbers, when you're looking at a California-only wind and solar load resource mix versus an ISO footprint-wide, you will get potentially very different values in those county rules, and so it does create kind of some challenges for us to overcome. So, again, without kind of pointing us in a specific direction, I just want to kind of throw that out there as one of the challenges is why we're kind of looking at this as a uniform county rules methodology that would be overseen by the ISO.
Thanks, Carl. So go ahead, Meredith.
Can I just go back to my original point, which is I think this timeline is therefore problematic because this doesn't give us a lot of time to figure out you know, when the rubber actually hits the road at T-minus 45, if all of a sudden we're counting things differently.
I would just, you know, point out that
we're
going
to
actually have it
May.
Posted way back in May, so you'll have the entire time frame to talk to us about that value. We're going to have, you know, a process where you could talk to us and say, we have issue with that, and, you know, I think we would address your concerns at that point in time. So I don't think that it would be where we were trying to make adjustments in the monthly time frame for this that would need to be set up before people were doing their procurement in the beginning of the year and the year ahead.
Unfortunately, we have seen that things do sometimes get to, like, December when we find out that CAISO is counting something differently, which is what happened with demand response last year. So just, you know, experience has shown. And so, you know, maybe part of the stakeholder process needs to be, what do we do in May and June when you publish your uniform counting rules? And is there, like, a standing stakeholder process every summer to talk about discrepancies? Maybe it won't be needed, but it seems like that needs to be part of this plan, is how we work through differences and give the LSEs plenty of time, recognizing the fact that our LSEs generally contract many, many years in advance and not, you know, over the summer for the coming year.
So, Meredith, just to kind of clarify, and this is Carl, are you contemplating something a bit more detailed than the process we go through now when we release the NQC and EFC list? And again, that happens, we realize, sometimes back in the July, early August, or August time frame, which is snug, but again, we're relying on the QC list to do the NQC list, so, you know, we're trying to coordinate that effort. What we're proposing is to put a list out in May, in which time LSEs, LRAs, SCs for resources will all have an opportunity to review that list. If they had any issues or concerns or questions about it, they have an opportunity to contact the ISO and communicate those concerns, and we have from May until October to resolve that. Or are you contemplating something very formal, like a stakeholder process in which we do that?
I think that something else is needed, because this isn't what you currently do for the most part. Like, yes, there are default rules, but they rarely apply, and currently, you know, we work together and adopt counting conventions. You're part of our proceeding. We're part of your stakeholder process, and we haven't adopted contradictory rules before. So we're setting up a situation where the CPUC decision comes out in June and you've published your counting rules. We changed something because we can do that. You didn't change something, or you created rules that are inconsistent, and now it affects, you know, all of our jurisdictional LSEs and all of their procurement. So I'm suggesting that we should plan for that contingency and have, yes, something more formal in place, because it's not just about, oh, this resource seems to have a discrepancy. It's, we just adopted rules through a CPUC decision that are different than yours.
Okay, so this is Chris. So my view on that is that we're trying to set up these uniform counting rules to be used across the footprint. And once we establish those under this process, that would, what would be the rules going forward. Changing the rules would require another, you know, stakeholder process, and I don't think we're intending that we would do that every year. It's that, that those would be established so that there would be some consistency for things like what Carrie had mentioned, you know, the contracting and those concerns. You know, I, as you said, people do this for a long time out, so I don't think we're trying to, you know, create rules where the values are changing all the time. We want to have some consistency for that purpose as well. But I think that it's very reasonable to ask for where we could have a discussion on individual resources if something, if there's a discrepancy between what, you know, the regulatory agency or the LSE or resource owner says that it's worth and what our accounting rules have came up with. I think there's certainly plenty of opportunity to have that kind of a discussion. But in my mind, the accounting rules wouldn't be run through a stakeholder process every year.
That's not what I was suggesting, but I'm going to stop making suggestions for now. Thanks, because I'm just taking up everyone's time.
No, that's fine. This is a working group. I'm very fine with you, you know, providing those kind of, that kind of input. I think that's good. But so that's kind of the intent that I think that we're thinking about as going forward with filing and getting approval to do these kind of uniform counting. All right. Is there anybody on the phone? No one on the phone. All right. So does anyone else have any other discussion on this uniform counting rules issue? If not, I'm going to move forward and start talking about the backstop procurement and that cost allocation stuff. Anyone? All right. Well, thanks for all the input on that. I think that was good. So now we're going to talk about this, the timeline for when we would do backstop and how the cost allocation would flow from that sort of thing. So we talked earlier about this potential to secure. So in the T-minus 42 to T-minus 25 timeframe, there's a couple opportunities for LSEs to do some adjustments to their plans, go out and procure more, provide more on their plans, on their RA plans. And then At that T-minus 25 time frame, the ISO would have to make a decision on backstop. That's when we would actually issue that backstop if we make that decision that's needed. So, again, I want to make this very clear. This is the intent of under regional RA. We would only engage in any decision for backstop procurement in a situation when there was an identified cumulative deficiency that remains uncured. So that means across the whole system, if you add up all of the procurement from all LSEs, and that's below what the system-wide need is, that's when we would engage in this decision if it remains uncured after those cure periods. Noah?
Hey, Chris, just a clarification. We've been talking a lot about system. Just a question on if the ISO also does this on a local basis, on a monthly basis.
Monthly? Yeah, so that's another question. I wasn't really going to get into that, but right now we just do it like in the annual time frame. We make sure that there's enough, you know, procured, and then that on local that run that flows through every month, right? So, so we're gonna if we go way back in the beginning, I think we're talking about the validations. No, that's okay. I just wanted to point out that we are planning on still doing the local assessment, you know, every month, make sure that everybody has that.
Wait, did you say every month, Ben?
Yeah, make sure that everyone's requirement is met.
And that's what the ISO, if...
Yeah, we're not going to be, like, running a new LCR study or something like that every month. That's not the intent of it. It's just simply an accounting saying, yes, okay, your requirement was X, you have X, provided X. That's what we would be doing under this reliability assessment.
And if not, the ICM local.
If there is overall a deficiency in that TAC area,
okay.
That's the intent, yeah.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. I think that was a good, good way to get that explanation out there, actually. So thank you for the question. Okay, so let's move through into the cost allocation. So if we make that decision that we need to, oh, sorry, never mind. First, Alan, go ahead.
Hi, this is Alan Worker, PG&E. I just wanted to clarify a comment that you just made to Noah, just to make sure that's clear so that people aren't confused. When you say that there's a deficiency on the TAC area, if you're talking about a specific sub-region or a specific local area that is deficient, are you going to not backstop for those particular issues? Only if the overall TAC area is deficient are you going to backstop? Is that what you're referring to?
That's my understanding of the current process, and we weren't intending to change that. Do you want to add something, Carl?
Yeah, so to be clear, first things first, the ISO's backstop authority is always a may. I don't want anybody to sit here and think that, you know, we're looking to change this to we're 1 megawatt short. We're going out there and we're backstopping. Okay, it's always a may based on ISO discretion, but also based on deficiencies within the local area. And so what Chris is really talking about when we do part of the assessment, we're looking at whether or not the way the procurement accounting works is the local areas are assessed. We add up the total. I'm going to confuse the cumulative versus collective. The total cumulative local procurement in that area as one of the metrics for backstop procurement. If that number is met, then on a month ahead. My recollection is we would not be performing backstop. That's not to say there wouldn't be a need for exceptional dispatch for reliability purposes during the month. It's really just focusing on that month ahead backstop procurement.
Yeah, thanks, Carl. That's what my understanding is as well. So I hope that answers your question, Alan. Okay, so now we're going to talk about the cost allocation piece. So if we do make that decision, we saw accumulated deficiency that remained uncured, then all those associated costs of any type of a backstop would be allocated to those LSEs that have not met their individual RA requirement. So this is what we talked about kind of way back in the beginning of this process when we were describing how the cost allocation would work under regional RA. It's similar to the rules today. The current rules say, you know, if we see a cumulative deficiency, then the LSE proportional share of that backstop would be allocated to them. So and Carl helped me out making sure that this was written correctly, but this is essentially the the way that we would determine the cost allocation here on this this example, or the this equation, excuse me. So it's however much backs up we were procuring, and you know it doesn't have to be the total amount that all the LSEs have actually been shown to be deficient. If there were some shortages in their supply plan and their RA plans, excuse me, it's essentially we take the amount that we had to backstop that we decided was necessary to maintain reliability, and we multiply that by the LSE's actual showing deficiency divided by the sum of all of those deficiencies for all of the identified LSEs that are deficient. So I'm going to go through some examples of what that really means. Okay, so so this one we have. So the first example, trying to be start off again simple and then move forward into some other examples. So this one, three LSEs, each has a 100 megawatt requirement. LSC 1 met their RA requirement, 100 megawatts. LSC 2 and LSC 3 are short. LSC 2 has provided 50 megawatts on their RA plan, and LSC 3 has provided 75 megawatts. So what happens then? Okay, so this is, we see a system-wide deficiency of 75 megawatts. So just assume that we decided that we were going to backstop at 75 megawatts in this situation. We saw that LSEs 2 and 3 are deficient, so those are the ones that would be identified as having an obligation for that cost allocation. So what happens? So we look at, again, that sum of the all the deficiencies of the deficient LSEs, and that's kind of one of the drivers here for this cost allocation. So we say, okay, those two LSE 2 and 3 were 75 megawatts short total. So we look and we say, what is the percentages of the of that overall deficiency that each of those LSEs deficiency is. So on this one, we got 50 megawatts out of 75 megawatts for LSE 2. So that's two-thirds of that overall. So 66% of those costs of allocating, of procuring the backstop would actually be allocated to LSE 2. And then LSE 3, they have 25 megawatts of that overall 75 megawatt deficiency, and so 33% of those costs would be allocated to LSE 3. LSE 1 met the requirement, so they would not be allocated any cost under this situation. Caller on the phone? Okay, let's go to the phone.
Hi, this is Barbara Barkovich for CLECA. I have a follow-up question on your response to Alan Wecker's question, because I heard the words TAC area, I heard the words local area. It's not clear to me when you are backstopping how you're defining the area where you are looking for the deficiency. So could you please clarify that?
Okay, so my understanding currently is that we look at the TAC area, and there's one number that we add up for the total need of all of the local areas in that TAC area. And the LSEs have a pro rata load share requirement of that local need for that overall TAC area. And if we saw that overall local requirement for the entire TAC area was not met, that's when we would engage in a decision if we needed to backstop. Is that clear?
You're saying you look at some of what's available in all the local areas. Does that include all the different LCAs, and you might have a deficiency in one, but you might have a surplus in another one? I'm just really trying to understand how this works.
Yes, that's what the current situation is, and we're not trying to change that process under this regional RA initiative.
Okay, thank you. I think that's clearer to me now. I appreciate it.
Okay. Nora, did you want to add on at all? Okay. Thanks, Barbara. Okay, so this one was kind of a simple example, but I want to go through and see what happens if perhaps the ISO procures a different level of backstop, and then how would that work? So in the previous example, right, so the LSE 2 would be essentially procuring 50 megawatts. The cost of procuring 50 megawatts would be allocated to them, and then the cost of procuring 25 megawatts would be allocated to LSE 3. But in this next example, let's show how, okay, so we saw that in this case, the requirements remain the same for each of the LSEs, but LSE 1 has actually provided an additional 25 megawatts on their plan, so they came in long on their plan, essentially. Then we still see 50 megawatts from LSE 2 and 75 megawatts from LSE 3. So we see overall still a system-wide deficiency of 50 megawatts. So, again, assume that we did 50 megawatts of backstop in this case. We saw that LSCs 2 and 3 are deficient. The sum of those deficiencies is 75 megawatts. So, they have that same proportional share. 50 megawatts of 75 gives LSC 2 66% of the cost. But since they're actually we're only procuring 50 megawatts and some other entities that came in a little bit long, then essentially the cost of procuring 33 and a third megawatts of that 50 megawatts would be LSC 3. Similarly, they have 25 megawatts of that 75 overall sum of the LSC's deficiency in their plans. So they're making up 33% of that sum of those LSC deficiencies on their individual plans, and then that means that they would have the cost of procuring essentially 16 and two-thirds megawatts under this scenario. So this kind of explains how, there might be a potential for some entities to, not see the full cost of a backstop procurement if someone else was to, provide some additional capacity on their plan. So this is essentially kind of demonstrating that there is a potential for some leaning in this situation, but the ISO is mainly concerned with the idea of having enough system-wide, right? So we're not going to say that we're going to backstop to every individual LSC. It's simply if the overall system need is shown that there's still a system-wide deficiency. Okay, so let's go through example three now. So in this one, again, trying to demonstrate that, if someone comes in long and there's still some short, that it might all work out. We wouldn't actually have to do a backstop. So again, same three LSEs, same requirements, 100 megawatts each. On this one, the LSE 1 has shown 150 megawatts. So they're 50 megawatts long and they're showing. LSE 2 and 3 have both shown 75 megawatts, so they're 25 below their requirement each. But overall, the ISO sees no cumulative deficiency in this situation, so there would be no backstop procurement decision necessary in this example. All right, so those are kind of the different examples trying to portray how the cost allocation would work. It can get, a little bit complicated when you use different numbers, but the overall, idea here is that formula that Carl helped me write out at the beginning of this. So, Noah, you got a question?
Yeah, Chris, Noah Tong, SDG. Two questions.
Speak up a little bit, sorry.
Sorry, two questions. One, given that a PRM, the ISO is going to be calculating or setting may be different than that of the LRA, does the deficiency calculation for the particular LSEs under that LRA, might that be higher? And will you be talking about that?
Yeah, so I'd say this is like a parallel question to that uniform accounting rules question that you asked earlier. And again,
I only ask the easy questions.
Yeah, these are the easy ones. That's it. Thank you very much for the, T-ball question here. So essentially we're saying that we would want to use a system-wide PRM to do this assessment. So we would not be looking at if an individual LRA said that their PRM should be a certain level. If there's a difference there, there would be, no change in the validation process or any impact to the way that we saw a cumulative deficiency. We would be using that system-wide PRM that we're intending under the proposal.
Go ahead. Second question is, since you also look at the local plans or the megawatts for the local showings on a monthly basis, is the ISO proposing or thinking about changing CPM such that it's only CPMing local rather than a bundled product?
That's a good question. Oh, are you speaking of how we're talking about that splitting the local and?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. I'm not super familiar with that. Does someone else want to try to get into that, Carl? Thanks.
So again, to give context, as I understand it, to everybody else regarding Noah's question, as I'm understanding, you're talking about the ISO's proposal in RSI 2, whereby an LSE would have a local showing as well as a system showing. Is the question focused on would we be backstopping a resource just for local or just for system?
Right, because you could have a situation where your system is not deficient, but rather you might have a local deficiency. So in order to lower costs of CPM, are you expecting to split up the CPM cost for local versus system?
So I think as Chris pointed out earlier in his presentation, the local, the discussion on local as far as what and how backstop would occur, we're not proposing specific changes in this initiative. Those are happening in RSI 2. So backstop as it would occur would be based on the provisions determined in RSI 2, which again, as you know, that policy is still under development right now. I don't know that that's a very satisfying answer to you. I don't know that I have a more complete one at this point in time.
This is Keith Johnson. Let me see if I can clarify. Under CPM, we currently have the authority to backstop for local. We have it for both the individual deficiency as well as for a collective deficiency. We've never had an instance where we needed to exercise it, but we do have that authority. We're not planning to change that authority, nor are we planning to eliminate that authority as part of regional RA. The main change in regional RA that we're talking about in CPM is simply to insert tariff language to acknowledge that there will be a reliability assessment done using certain parameters, PRM, uniform accounting rules, and that that is, you know, a type of backstop procurement. It's really very similar to the current CPM authority where there's a deficiency. In our view, one, it maybe it's too simplistic a view, is that this is just a form of a deficiency, and we just want to be able to point to that there's a reliability assessment that could trigger it. Now, the other thing that we may need to explore further with you folks, though, is there cost allocation implications to this that we may need to refine? But the basic authorities we're not proposing to change, and the basic concepts of showings versus requirements versus deficiencies, we're not proposing to change either.
Thanks, Keith. Okay, so let's go to Carrie.
Carrie Bentley, WPTF. So I want to push back a little bit, Keith, on what you said in the conversation earlier about local capacity. So just to tee it up, system capacity right now in the CAISO is really cheap, right? Where the money is and where people really care about is it's local capacity. The tariff, I think, is fairly unclear, you know, in its description on when the ISO has the ability to CPM for this. I mean, Chris gave a description of it, and Alan, I'm going to call you out under his breath. He's like, that's not what the tariff said. And I agree with Alan. That's not what the tariff says. And so the tariff has some interesting quirks on when the ISO has the ability to designate CPM. For example, as Keith said, there are two ways, right? You could have a monthly insufficiency, or you could have this collective deficiency, right? In the monthly, the ISO has to count all capacity, even if it's outside the local area, right? And they have to count things like RMR contracts. That tariff language doesn't naturally translate, I think, to a west-wide ISO. And it's a little bit confusing, too, to know if you're not in a local capacity area, do you get to count for the TAC? Do you just get to count for that local capacity area? These are questions, I think, that haven't been articulated very clearly in this regional RA process. Also, the answer that the TAC only matters, I don't think that's true. I think you guys have the ability to look down deeper into the local areas. And I know you've brought Catalan in, and he's explained things a few times, and that's helpful from a really technical perspective. But I know our members would really appreciate if you could just translate that local, you know, the local rules into English, because the tariff is really unclear. But I think when you go through that process and you translate it into English, you'll realize the rules probably change. There probably does need to be a discussion around it. And I can't emphasize enough how much that matters, because that's where the money is. That's what people really care about. So I would really appreciate that topic being taken up.
Okay.
So Carrie, let me just, you know, respond. You said you pushed back. I didn't think you really pushed back. I think your comment is just fine. And I would acknowledge it would probably be helpful for us to walk through that and explore, you know, to what extent it's maybe not unclear or could be made more clear, or maybe it needs revision, but I just wanted to kind of at a high level describe it, but I'm not taking issue with your comment, and please include that in your comments.
So, and I would also note that what I was describing, Carrie and Alan were speaking to, is my understanding of how we currently assess it. Okay, so I'm not familiar with exactly what the tariff language says on it, so I acknowledge that there may be some need for clarity as well. Carl, do you want to add something?
Yeah, so to Carrie's point, so we're really talking about tariff sections 40.2.2, or 43.2.2, and I think 43.2.3, to give us at least some specificity about what we're talking about in the terms under which the ISO can issue a backstop. And there's two conditions under which we can do it. Yes, I reviewed these just about yesterday, Alan. Condition one, the first condition is a deficiency in an LSE-specific showing. Condition two is if we identify collective deficiency, which is, again, when we look at all of the resources in a local area and say, collectively, are they effective? Do we have the ability to meet reliability in that area? What I think Chris and I, at least particularly in this discussion, have been focusing on is really the question of 43.2.2, which is the, I guess if you will, the summation, the aggregate, not the collective deficiency. That's really what we've been focused on. So just to add some clarity on what we are referencing, that's what we're referencing. And again, you could go through there, and to Carrie's point, is there still ambiguity in those two sections? Well, I think one could make an argument that we could tighten that language up. We're looking at that currently in RSI 2. And again, what we're identifying is in RSI 2 is how to deal really particularly what that RSI 2 proposal focuses on is 43.2.2, which is taking the idea of looking at an LSE showing, seeing what it has flagged on that showing as local capacity. So again, we have an identification of what it has procured. Are we doing the collective, kind of that overall locational assessment differently, to Carrie's point of, you know, are we including all the resources, whether they're directly in that or just simply impact that local area? No, we did not propose any changes to that assessment. Really, what we're only talking about in RSI 2 is how do we add up the resources on an LSE showing to determine if there's an LSE-specific deficiency. Again, that's RSI 2. I know most of you in this room are tuned into that. So stay tuned. We're working on a bit more detail on that proposal.
So, yeah, I would just say that, you know, I think that it's very reasonable to ask those kind of questions. I was trying to focus on the system-wide stuff, not so much on local in this piece. But I think that, you know, we should probably be able to, you know, discuss if that needs to be added or some kind of changes need to be done under this process for local. But again, we do have that other process going on with RSI 2. So is there one on the phone? Alan, go ahead.
Yeah, I got called out, so I feel like I have to say something. So this is Alan Wecker from PG&E. I just wanted to clarify the comment that I made about what you were saying not being in tariff. It is in the tariff. It's just I think there needs to be a lot more clarity, and I think from PG&E's standpoint, we view this regional initiative as an opportunity to simplify and to clarify so that external entities will know what they're getting into. And so from that standpoint, I think the idea of whether you're going to do a collective deficiency on a local area or a TAC area, what the actual tariff says and what your actual process is, if those differ, I think we're seeing that as a potential issue. And so if that could be clarified and the tariff could be tightened up to match what the actual CAISO believes its needs are, that would be beneficial and should be within the scope of this initiative.
All right. Well, I think we'll have to have some discussion on that internally, get back to you about, you know, if we're going to include that or not. So go ahead, Keith.
So I wanted to just touch on, you know, we talked a little bit about in the course of this morning, we've talked a little bit about accounting rules and showings, and we even talked a little bit about the PRM level, and we talked about backstop. So I just wanted to remind us all that there's a number of things that are having an interplay here. You know, we also talked about the ability of entities to establish maybe accounting rules. I'd ask folks to think about these things, you know, kind of keep a perspective. So, for example, the uniform counting rules that we're talking about is a cap on the maximum amount that a particular resource ID could count or be, you know, contracted for or used for RA capacity. You know, I think that what I seem to hear a lot of times when people are talking about this is they, you know, jump to a conclusion, for example, that an LRA might want to establish some value that's higher than that. And we have a problem. I don't know. I mean, we talked, and Carrie was right. I mean, in our current balancing authority area, I think there's 33 LRAs. And if we were to expand our footprint, a lot more than that. I don't know that all of them want to do counting rules. I don't know that all of them would want to choose something different than what the ISO uses. And I don't know if a lot of them would want to use some value bigger. They might want to use a smaller value. I don't know. But let's bear that in mind before we jump to the conclusion that everyone wants to have higher values in the ISO because ISO cooked up some crazy study that came up with ridiculously low numbers. It's not our intent. Same thing with planning reserve margin, that we would do a study and it would be done through a stakeholder process and you all would know what it is and we would have buy-in, hopefully, and everyone would say, that's really good. I wouldn't necessarily assume that LRAs are going to want to establish lower PRMs than the ISO. They might want to have higher ones. They want to use the same one. And remember, too, my comment about suppliers are going to know what the maximum value for their resources are. I'm not sure they're going to go out and contract for numbers higher than that. They could. I hope you might recognize that there's a little bit of risk here. If we were to say folks could have some flexibility, suppliers could sell more than their maximum value. Folks could contract for it. They might LSEs or might not buy all of the megawatts of a resource. Some LSEs might over-procure and cover under-procured LRAs or LSEs. So there's a lot going on here, and it doesn't automatically flow that if someone had a lower PRM than the ISOs, that there's a deficiency in a CPM. It doesn't automatically flow that if we have maximum counting rules that everyone's going to contract up to the maximum value and we're going to have all these showings come in and we're going to have discrepancies. There's a lot of interplay here where people could do these kinds of things I'm talking about. Some might over-procure slightly. Some might not push the limit, if you will, in a PRM. And we'll be just fine and we're not going to need to have backstop procurement. So there's a lot of stuff going on here with the way people would be actually, you know, procuring and showing in practice and, you know, doing all kinds of things like substitution and replacement, which we're not talking about today. But it doesn't flow that the ISO is going to do a whole bunch of backstop procurement. The ISO has done very little backstop procurement since its existence. The numbers are very small. Now, granted, we're going to a new, larger footprint. World could be slightly different. There might be backstop procurement done in different ways in the sense of it might occur more frequently. I don't know that to be the case, but I want us to try to keep in perspective about what backstop is. It's the last thing that the ISO would do only if there was a deficiency that wasn't cured. It's only done on a summation basis, you know, where we look at all of the RA showings, all the megawatts that have been shown as RA for a particular type of RA. The tariff requires that we also then say, oh, did the ISO do any RMR capacity? That has to be counted too. Oh, did the ISO do any CPM procurement in advance, you know, for a month or two out or, you know, whatever we've done? That has to be counted too. So we count all of these capacities that we have before we would ever do a CPM procurement. And then there's a cost allocation that we hope is fair. If folks are individually responsible, so to speak, you know, there could be ramifications for them. But if folks have fulfilled their requirements, you know, if you read about the CPM, you'll see that there are instances where we might do a CPM, but it's spread to all loads. For lack of a better word, nobody's fault. So I wanted to just kind of give that perspective of CPM and showings and compliance because I think it's important to bear in mind.
Yeah, thanks, Keith. I think that kind of gives like a bigger picture of some of this stuff, and I've been talking a lot about the details. So, yeah, you know, I think that was helpful. So We are about 10 minutes away from noon, so what I'm going to do is I'm just going to ask everyone if they would like me to go back through any of these examples right now, if there was anything that wasn't clear from this, because after lunch I'll just turn it over to Carl to talk about the next topic. So if there's no clarification needed, then we can take an early lunch.
Please.
We want Mohan. Sure.
Yeah, Mohan, you will see the Lord. I just want to understand a clarification on what motivates LSU want to go for longer showings.
So, for instance, there might be an LSE that, you know, owned a resource and they just decided to put it on their plan. Might have one resource that has 150 megawatt value and they decided they didn't want to sell the other 50 megawatts to someone else and they wanted to just, you know, avoid any potential, you know, replacement needs or something like that and decided they would put that on a showing. We're not saying that that had to happen, but this is just kind of trying to show the example of if someone were to provide additional capacity beyond their requirement, how there might be a situation where some LSEs might not have to provide all the way up to their requirement, and there wouldn't be a cumulative deficiency. So it was really for illustrative purposes. I don't think that there would be an incentive for folks to show a whole bunch extra.
They would be selling to some other LSEs, supplier would sell to an LSE that has obligation, right? So why would they buy, more than what is required?
My kind of explanation was perhaps this is just an LSE that owns that resource already. So, you know, it might be an IOU like PG&E, for instance, that has a resource that they, you know, decided for whatever reasons, you know, financial reasons, they didn't want to sell it to someone else. They just want to keep it as part of their portfolio, but they showed it. You want to add something, Carl?
Yeah, Mohan, I think just to add on to Chris's point, really the purpose of this last example is not to say that somebody would have an incentive to do it, but really to demonstrate what would happen if somebody, you know, as a precaution said, you know what, I don't want to risk being deficient. We're not going to have an opportunity to go back and recheck this. We're going to throw in a couple extra megawatts just as a precaution. So what would happen? And somebody says, well, I don't know that I can get enough, and they come in a little bit short. We kind of want to put out the idea of, you know, is it something that we would exercise if you specifically was short? No. It's really something that we would exercise or have the authority if and only if the system-wide was deficient. So that's really the goal of this example, not really to point out that there'd be an incentive or desire or anything other than somebody came in a little bit long.
Yeah, and I think we wanted to also portray that today we see, for instance, some of the IOUs will actually provide us more than what their requirement is in their showing. So, you know, we're seeing that kind of happen today. Oh, LSEs, sorry, the LSEs. But anyhow, so any other questions on these examples? If not, we can break for lunch. Awesome. All right. So let's come back at 1 p.m. Enjoy your lunch, everyone. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to what I think will mercifully be a fairly short section for this afternoon. We want to talk at least briefly about outage and substitute capacity. This is an element we've heard some questions and concerns from stakeholders about the particular need and specific need for having substitute capacity, especially in a world where we have a planning reserve margin and trying to identify what is driving the need to actually have some of these incentives in place that we have. And again, we want to clarify what the substitute capacity is. I think many people typically review it as a requirement. It is not a requirement. We'll talk a little bit more about it being more of an opportunity. That wasn't even intended to be funny, Noah. Okay. So with that, let's get going really quickly. So we wanted to kind of build up a little bit and just kind of get an understanding as, you know, to what the ISO is attributing to and kind of what goes into thinking about creating a planning reserve margin and what drives it. And I think, obviously, when you're looking at a planning reserve margin, the thing that most clearly underlies it is your forecast. What's your peak forecast supposed to look like? And so when we're doing this in the year-ahead time frame and trying to plan ahead, we know that we're going to have to serve peak load. We also know that we're going to have to maintain a certain amount of reserves based on some of the new FERC regulations. We are able to change our reserves. It was 7. We're down to 6. So when we think about what our day-to-day operating needs are, moving towards in a planning space, again, where we're looking at some forward procurement planning space, we know that we're going to have to expect to actually have available to us 106% of our expected forecasted peak. We also know that at some point in time there's going to be forecast error. We are, again, trying to plan into the future, sometimes as far as a year ahead, sometimes monthly. But we know that that forecast error is going to be there. We also know there's going to be some forced outages that are going to happen unexpectedly in the real time or in a time frame close enough to real time that we really can't get something back up online. And so in trying to figure out how to set a PRM, again, you can do it in a variety of different ways. We'll talk in other forums about loss of load probabilities and some of those studies. But the planning reserve margin at 115 is really designed to account for the forecasts, reserves, and some combination of forecast error and forced outages. So again, that's kind of how it derives. But let's talk about a bit more about really kind of what in potential can happen with that forecast error. Potentially, we've seen forecast error, again, since we're talking such a distant horizon, in the neighborhood of about 5% potentially. Forced outages on some days as high as 12. Now, I'm not going to stand up here, and I can't do it in good conscience and say that we think it's a high probability event that we're going to have the maximum amount of forecast error and the maximum amount of forced outages occurring simultaneously, but in theory, it is possible. And so in theory, it's possible that we could need as much as 123% of the potential maximum forecasted peak load. So again, we're just kind of talking generally about how it can derive. So with this in mind, with the idea that, yes, we know in theory we could get above it, studies have shown that generally speaking, 115, we can reliably plan around it and account for some of these real-time forced outages. But we also know that reporting of outages, whether they be planned or forced, the more foresight the ISO has into these, the better it's able to accommodate both the outage itself as well as maintain reliability within the system. Anybody besides Noah? Okay, Noah.
Hey, Carl. Noah Tynes, DGNE. Can you enlighten me on why the 6% reserves doesn't account or wouldn't be used for forecast error?
No, I can't.
Okay.
It's too late, Noah. No, the 6%, remember, those are the contingencies. Those are the resources we have to maintain as kind of the what-ifs, the spinning reserves, the contingency reserves that we have to keep online available just in case something happens in that real time so that we can have resources available for contingency events. Anybody but Alan? It's really just... All right, since I opened myself up to that, Alan, we'll get to you next. I'm sorry.
Okay, so this is Paul Nelson from Southern California. So this just has a question I just want to ask. So you just said then the reserves are needed for unexpected outages real time. That sounds a lot like the forced outage on your graph.
So those outages can be for the contingencies can be for transmission outages as well as the generation outages. So we do try and maintain some of the forced outages, again, they may not necessarily result in a contingency, but we do need to have the capacity available to us really to kind of maintain an effective dispatch. Does that help? Not going to help? Still sounds like double counting? I got a bunch of people shaking my head that it sounds like. So I just want to be clear then. I want to ask this question and throw it out to you. Because I have the three LSEs kind of like looking at me like, huh? Or IOUs, I should say. Are we making the assertion, or are you making the assertion that really we should be getting by with 106% planning reserve margin? Okay, so then help enlighten me, Alan. what you are implying and slash inferring.
Yeah. Hi, this is Alan Wecker, PG&E. I think it's just the construction of the explanation that you're giving here that we're questioning and just providing a little skeptical questioning of. You know, in terms of these reserves, they are reserves that are required under reliability criteria. And I think the question is, when you go from an operational space to a planning space, how much of that reserves should you take into account in your forced outage planning? You know, I think that's kind of the question. And so the way that you've done this water flow chart to show that reserves are independent of forced outages gives the impression that you're saying that they should not be overlapping in any way, whereas, you know, they could be, and that's why you might have a reasonably expected metric as opposed to a maximum potential need. I think that's just the comment that we're making.
So the comment that you're making, again, so that I understand, and if I'm going to ever present this chart again, I can clarify the explanation to help, is that some portion of that 106 is also included in that 9. So the blue is kind of overlapped with the 9 in some regards?
Or the 12.
Okay. All right. Thanks. So any other thoughts, comments, questions? I will try and clarify and improve the descriptions on this chart to help out. Alan, you actually had a point earlier. Meredith, we'll get to you in a moment.
Yeah, sorry. I think the reason why we're making this point, I'm saying as if I represent other entities than me, so I'll just say PG&E thinks it's important to make that point when you talk about how RAME incents replacement substitution of forced outages, that makes it a different kind of calculation in terms of how much you should plan for forced outages in your PRM. If you are already providing the incentives to replace for forced outages, should you necessarily include forced outages in your PRM?
So I think that's the question. And I appreciate you kind of leading into that, Alan. We're going to get to that discussion because, again, one of the benefits of RAME is it's not just kind of a back-end tool. There's front-end pieces to it that are very helpful. There's kind of that middle of the time horizon where, you know, we're starting to see the outages that makes it helpful. And then there's kind of the after-the-fact assessment about who's really providing the benefit and providing incentives to provide that benefit. So that's really you're really kind of with that question and kind of with that direction, really pointing at the heart of what we wanted to get at through the course of these slides. So I really greatly actually appreciate the lead-in, and we'll get to it in a couple minutes. Meredith, you had a comment you wanted to make?
I'm probably also jumping ahead, but we didn't comment on this point, but we agree with the comments of other utilities regarding, you know, if we're calling it a planning reserve margin, then we're using that for planning, but when it comes to other things, I think, you know, we get into issues around potentially double penalizing or double counting for something, and so we share the concerns of others.
Thanks. Yeah, and I think one of the things that we look at in terms of the availability incentive mechanism as far as double penalizing, it's set up the way it is today specifically to try and avoid some of that double penalties. Some could argue they're, you know, RAME and for example, an E4D are compatible. Others would say it's a double penalty. I don't know that we'll necessarily get deeply into that discussion, but it is a point we'll raise today, that the goal is not to double penalize, but to make sure that the capacity that's been procured, that's been sold, is there, it's available, it's performing. I think many of us have kind of been through the ringer on this discussion, but we'll kind of talk through that a little bit more as we go. Caller in queue.
Operator, if we can go to the caller in queue.
Okay.
Caller, if you could state your name and the company you represent.
From Barclays, and yes.
Go ahead.
Come again.
Hello. Can you hear me?
We got you now.
This is Sarita Sarwate from Barclays, and yes.
Okay.
And my question is, why are there two forecast errors? There is 9% reasonably expected forecast error and forced outages, and then piled on top, there is 5% forecast error. later on. So that's
right.
It's too much. Yeah.
Yeah, so what we tried to do there is kind of, and again, we talked about reasonably expected forecast error and forced outages in that. And so the idea was that that was a combination. It wasn't an attempt to identify or isolate any one of those in particular. So what we looked at with the yellow bar as opposed to the orange bars, if we look at what forecast error could would maximize at about 5%, and then look at forced outages again, because it's basically a similar question to what was asked earlier, that could be as high as 12%. And I think this demonstrates what Alan was getting to with the potential for double counting, which is how much of that 12 is considered in the 6. I'll have to think about my graphics a little more clearly on that one. Most people in the hopefully that was a reasonable explanation about where that 5% is coming from. It's not intended to pile on, but to kind of isolate and identify maximum potential errors.
So you're saying it's a 5% is like what the 9% is reduced to, or
5% may be a subset of that overall 9.
Right, but then you know, to me, forecast error is a different entity than forced outage. So I think
we understand that.
Yeah. So this is kind of confusing the way all these different numbers.
Anyway. Okay, so I think what we're running into is as much an issue with the graphic, probably more than the concepts we're discussing. Again, I want to clarify that. You know, when we see that 9%, it could be on any given time or within a month on a day. We could see 5% forecast error and 6% forced outage or 3% forced outage. And so that total overall combination of what that 9 would be at one specific point in time would actually be less than 9. But in theory, if the forecast error is coincident with the maximum amount of forced outage, we could exceed levels of where we were contemplating for the planning reserve margin. So, again, I guess it's a little confusing, and we can go back and try and tweak this graphic to make it a little bit clearer. But what we're really getting at here is the idea that absent additional incentives, we may find ourselves in a place where the planning reserve margin, due to the coincidence of forecast error and forced outage, may not be sufficient to ensure reliability. Again, so providing additional incentives to maintain some of those reserves, to maintain some of that planning reserve margin are beneficial. And that's really kind of where I was going to try and take this, really, to Alan's point earlier. What's that?
Okay, thank you.
I jinxed myself? Well, that was the fun. If it was quick, it wouldn't be fun.
Paul Nelson, Southern California Edison. So I'll just explain how I thought of it, which was kind of explained to me by predecessor Mark Minnick. So there's a certain amount of capacity you need because you never want to go up to the edge, and so that you've got your spin and your non-spin.
Mm-hmm.
So that's your reserves,
mm-hmm.
because you always want a little bit of extra. You don't want to be right at the edge. So that's your 6%. And then you've got forced outage rate. Now, what is you have? You don't have a forced outage rate. Call it 7%.
Okay.
So that takes us to what?
13.
And then about 4% for forecast error.
Yeah. So
that takes
17.
You to 15.
Oh, 17 by my math.
Or 17, so 4, yeah, 7.
And that's where the PUC, so, when they do their PRM, is at 115 to 117 for ranges like that. And again,
So that's kind of how I do it. As the back of the envelope is kind of what my spin, non-spin, what's my forecast error, and what sort of a system forced outage rate.
Yeah. And we have an alternative graphic that we've used in the past. We wanted to try to break it out a little bit more because, again, you're right, Paul. I mean, we do tend to lump many of those things together. We wanted to try and pull those out a little bit more. I don't want to downplay the 6% so you don't want to play on the edge. I mean, those are required reserves that we have to maintain every bit as much as serving peak load. Even at 106, I would assert you're kind of on the edge. So, but a point made and well taken. I thought I saw one other. Noah.
No, it's not. So the 12% or are the numbers above the 115 based on any historical, or are they just?
As I've understood these numbers, they are what we've seen is a maximum amount of force outage. I still have to go back and verify what those are.
In what time frame within the ISO?
Like I said, no, I'll have to go back and continue to verify exactly so I can give a better description of that. But generally speaking, even if it is consumed within part of that 6%, that you're still starting to push the 115 limit. So, again, I don't want to I feel like what we're doing here is we're getting caught more on the graphic than the concept, and I want to make sure that we understand the concept, which is trying to say, what we want out of this is to provide benefits to providing incentives to provide substitute capacity when outages occur. That's really the primary goal I want to get out of this. We'll get more detail about that in a moment. So we'll start with talking about planned outages because, again, the sooner we can know about outages, the better we can plan for them. And they may be outages that, the ISO can reasonably absorb without impacting its reliability. So when a resource comes to the ISO and submits a request for a planned outage, the ISO can review that, and based on its assessment, we could actually review and say, well, that outage is fine. We're still adequate in resource adequacy. We're flush with capacity. You can go ahead and take that outage. Don't worry about it. We actually don't even need substitute capacity on those. So resources that receive approval from a planned outage without substitution would be exempt from the RAME for the duration of that outage for which it's been approved. So, again, the sooner you know the report, you have an opportunity to have it exempted. And to that point, we'll examine those outages on a first-come, first-served basis. So the sooner you get in, the sooner you'll have an opportunity to have that outage assessed before other outages start to trickle in down the road. So getting that outage reported sooner has benefits. If the resource is needed ultimately, we could ask the SC to reschedule the outage, if they can reschedule it at all, if it's a planned maintenance that they can shift by a week or move to a weekend. We might issue that request. If they can do that, that's great. If not, the ISO may deny the outage if they're unable to provide substitute capacity or reschedule the outage. Outage is not moved or substitute capacity is not provided, then it may be redefined as a forced outage and would be subject to RAME availability. So what are the availability incentives and replacement opportunities? And again, I want to emphasize the word opportunities. It is not a requirement. We do not require resources provide substitute capacity. If they don't, we will calculate availability charges for them, but that's a choice that the individual resource SC makes as to whether or not it's cost effective for them to provide that replacement capacity. If they're willing to accept the calculation and then the potential charges that may ensue. So really what we're looking at, and again, this is kind of what I was talking about earlier, is it starts with an upfront incentive to provide incentive to take planned outages as opposed to force, and as well as take actions to reduce the occurrences of force outages. So take the maintenance, do the work, so that upfront, when you're going into the month, you know that your machine is ready to go. It's fully functional. It's operational. It's all greased up and just ready to fire up at a moment's notice. What? Okay. Appreciate it. Okay. Sorry. You're supposed to use your microphone, Virginia. So the way the ISO is currently doing, or in the process of doing, I should say, again, this is FERC-approved tariff. It's not currently ISO-implemented policy yet, but we're assessing availability based on bids into the ISO. Were you supposed to bid, and did you bid? Really what I'm specifically getting at is the question of the new RA availability incentive mechanism. Again, the currently existing standard capacity product is based on something different, which is are you on forced outage? So the new RA availability incentive mechanism moves to something more active, I guess, if you will, which is your actual participation in the market through bids or self-schedules, depending on whether you're a system/local resource or whether you're a flexible resource and meeting your must-offer obligation. There is a single availability metric for the price and price for the system, local and flexible capacity. So we don't have a differentiated price based on the RA capacity product that's provided. Again, it's a self-funded product, so any resource that's a poor performer pays up, they put it all into a pool. That pool is then divvied up proportionally to all the good players that are there available and exceeding the threshold availability metric. So, again, resources that go on forced outage may provide substitute capacity to avoid any of these outage charges. So if a resource goes on forced outage, they can say, well, I'm going on outage, but Noah's going to step in. He's going to fill in for me today. He's going to take over my must-offer obligation, so I'm good. And in that sense, that resource would be able to avoid its outage charges. They may. They don't have to. So I'll pause at that to see if there's any thoughts, comments, questions. Noah, you stepping in to help out? You can step to the podium if you want.
I did notice that both of us didn't wear a bow tie.
You know, I had an actual necktie on earlier, but I thought it would throw people off, so I just took it off.
The specific word of replacement going into 2018, I think, will make things confusing for folks.
Yeah. No, I as you point that out, I see that. We tried to – so Noah's point is that we're trying to do away with what I would argue is some of the most confusing language in the ISO tariff, and I frankly admit to getting it backwards on a very regular basis, which is the difference between replacement and substitute capacity. Show of hands, who gets it right all the time? Shut up, Noah.
Can you explain that more, though, Carl? Sorry, this is Chris from the ISO. I guess for some new people, for instance, it was hard for me to understand this when I came over from Michigan and, you know, understand that this is different from where other areas of the country, what they do in a lot of areas. So that's just one thing I think might be good to talk through, kind of that difference.
All right.
If you would like to do that right now.
At the risk of screwing it up, I actually do know Noah will get the nomenclature right. So, Noah, could you help me not screw this up?
Is there an actual question?
Chris, are you actually asking Noah to explain the difference between substitute and replacement?
I was just teeing it up for somebody to try to explain to everyone in the room if you would like to do so, because this is a working group and it's supposed to, you know, have more discussion. Maybe a very well-informed stakeholder could provide their view of it.
Yeah, so this is Noah from San Diego. Essentially, this goes back to 2010 when the CPUC and its stakeholders wanted to develop a thing called a standard capacity product, mainly to allow easy measure for folks to bilaterally transact capacity and making sure that, you know, 1 megawatt from one resource is just as equal to another megawatt from another resource. What came out of it, unfortunately, when the ISO went to FERC, maybe fortunate and unfortunate, but was that, one, you have a standard set of must-offer obligations for all resources, which is really good. The other thing that came out of it was the availability incentive mechanism, where the ISO penalizes for non-availability for a particular capacity amount from a resource. And that continued for a few years until 2016, when the ISO is now replacing this incentive and penalty with a new mechanism called RAME. SCP originally focused on outage availability, whereas this new RAME structure focuses on bidding and the structure at which somebody bids.
So
then,
if you could help, I got turned off. If you could help recall, and I think Gotham is just probably, he's back there too saying, I can help, the distinction between what replacement is versus substitute.
Sure. So replacement back when it was created for SCP was designated for planned outages, whereas substitution is created for forced outages. The ISO allows within both SCP and RAME the ability for a scheduling coordinator to provide substitute capacity in order to mitigate the financial penalties of non-availability.
Right. Perfect. And I think that descriptor really helps emphasize or kind of point to why it's confusing to try and have a different term to denote a forced versus a planned outage. What the ISO is moving to and what NOAA points out is we're actually moving to the idea of it's all substitute. It's planned outage substitute capacity or forced outage substitute capacity. The idea of differentiating between them based on planned versus forced replacement to substitution is going the way of the dodo. So through RSI 1.
So RSI 1B.
Yeah, as Gotham has pointed out, specifically through RSI 1B. But if he doesn't get the new one, okay, we'll change it back. I'm sorry, Paul. So, as Gotham pointed out, that'll be happening in RSI 1B filing soon to follow, and available on the RSI webpage.
Will there be any distinction under the new?
We will call it forced outage substitute capacity and planned outage substitute capacity. Better clarity. You going to be okay with that, Paul? Or will we expect a protest at FERC from SCE based on that? Paul just getting it. So we've kind of started to discuss some of the upfront benefits of trying to have this incentive, specifically making sure that we've got that the resources that are looking to sell RA are really kind of planning to make sure they're available to provide it. So now when we kind of start moving into that real that operational space, the availability incentive mechanism is really there to ensure resources relied upon for resource adequacy have an incentive to make that capacity available. So we avoid that. I sold my RA. Great. I'm going to go on outage for the month. Have fun. We really kind of like to avoid that. So, again, this provides an incentive to the resources to say, if you want to take that outage, you can do so, but it will basically come at the expense of a monthly capacity cost. Again, some of the discussion earlier that we have, some capacity is expected to be on forced outage during the month and accounted for in the planning reserve margin, but the incentive also exists to ensure that we kind of stay below that maximum threshold. We've got an incentive that is adequate enough for some of those resources to go out there and say, you know what, it's cheap enough for me to get replacement capacity to provide it to the ISO so they can maintain reliability and I can stay available, and they're not kind of hanging in the wind short of what we would otherwise expect to need for reasonable dispatch and planning. Again, one of the other things, and I mentioned this earlier in reference to Meredith's question, is the capacity values right now are not discounted based on a probability of forced outage. So if I'm a thermal resource that has outage of 50%, I'm really, half the time I go to turn on and, oops, I don't get there. And I have 100 megawatt Pmax. I'm still 100 megawatt Pmax resource for RA purposes. There's no discounting for that forced outage. So when you look around many other areas, there is an accounting for that E4D, that forced outage rate, where they discount them in trying to figure out what the right amount of forward procurement is to have. They do tend to rely on discounted RA values, the available capacity as opposed to some of the installed capacity. And then finally, one of the things that the PRM doesn't cover, and you'll get a variety of different thoughts on this one, I'm sure, but when we do our local planning, there's not a planning reserve margin for local regions. And so trying to have an incentive in place so that if resources in a local area go out, we don't have necessarily a very well-defined 6%, you can argue that based on the assumptions that go into the local planning, there's a margin for error based on some of the 1 in 10, N minus 1 minus 1 contingencies, but there's not specifically a planning reserve margin for local areas. So I did have Noah first, and then I'll get to you, Alan.
So, Carl, you have responded to Paul that ISO is going to, now that you're merging replacement and substitute capacity into one commonly known phrase.
Two phrases, just using substitute. There's forced hour substitution and
that's actually not true because the ISO's tariff that's posted on the website that's amendments.
It only says substitute.
It only says RA substitute capacity. Okay. It doesn't designate RA plan outage substitution or RA
forced
outage. So it would really be better if the ISO were to clear that up within the
I'm actually trying to read.
He's
active. It's just he's not close enough. I'll have to check with that to see if that's covered through the nature of work.
No, but I still think that you should, in the ISO's tariff for 1B, the defined term for RA substitute capacity to be defined as RA planned outage substitute capacity or RA forced outage substitute capacity.
I'll take that up with our legal team and see if they've identified it, if such a distinction is necessary based on their reading of the tariff. But I appreciate where you're coming from, though.
Just a comment on that. So we did think about this, and we really don't want to differentiate planned outage substitute capacity and forced outage substitute capacity because at the end of the day, it's RA substitute capacity, which becomes RA capacity. So we really didn't want to call that out and come up with a different definition for both because at the end of the day, it's all going to be RA capacity. It's just the process of submitting the substitution is a bit different when it comes to planned outages compared to forced outages.
And you wonder why people are confused with the ISO tariff or the VPM when that happens and have, you know, no understanding of what substitute or replacement is currently.
Yeah, that's what we want to fix part of RSI 1B.
But except for the fact that I think this will actually cause more confusion as you go down the pipe. Because you still have a planned outage process and you still have a forced outage process. By calling the same the same two different processes with one singular defined term causes a lot of confusion.
Okay, so here's what I'll suggest as at least a short-term substitute solution let's talk about this more offline. I think we're going to try not to get into discussion of tariff language in RSI 1B as part of this discussion, but again, appreciating the clarity that you're looking for, and I'm happy to talk with you about what the benefits and include Gotham and our legal team as far as what some of the drawbacks and thinking were from the ISO standpoint. So, again, appreciate we're not debating RSI 1B. Alan?
Hi, this is Alan Walker, PG&E. I just wanted to clarify or make sure that I understand the comment that you made on the last bullet about PRM not covering local capacity forced outage needs. When you guys are doing the TISO assessment of the TAC area, are you looking at 100% of the TAC need or are you looking at 115% of the TAC need?
We're looking at the local area needs, which are determined based on the local area studies, which are based on 1 in 10 load forecast, N minus 1 minus 1 contingencies.
Mm-hmm.
Not 115% of those.
Okay. Thank you.
Meredith?
Thanks, Carl. Just one caveat about something you said earlier about capacity values aren't adjusted based on how much a resource was on forced outage the year before. I think that there were aspects of your proposal for other kinds of resources that aren't like thermal generators wherein the availability from one year could actually affect the capacity value for the following year, like for DR and maybe for other like non-generating resources or other things where you were proposing sort of a historic look at availability as part of
RA value.
And so as part of that, again, I'm kind of probing as much as anything. I don't always have every single answer up here as much as I really love to. If that is in fact the case, what would you do? You have a potential resolution that you think would be reasonable to address if there is a potential overlap on that? And again, I want to be clear: there are people out there that would assert that even a E4D is not incompatible with RAME, with the idea that RAME is a penalty or a charge and slash benefit for capacity that's already been sold. The E4D D rate is kind of looking into the future to say what can we really expect to get next year, and so it's kind of checking out whether or not they're actually able to provide reliable capacity into the future versus what they've already sold. So
Sorry. We've
heard those arguments. I just kind of wanted to see.
So I didn't want to go there because I thought that would be jumping too far ahead and
okay. Away
from this point about replacement.
Okay.
But
I'm simply stating others' arguments. It's not necessarily one the ISO holds.
I think we agreed with others that, the RAME is the penalty for non-performance. And so if you are penalizing for non-performance under the RAME, then you don't also need to reduce the capacity value of that resource that was penalized in the following year. When it comes to, traditional resources, something that RAME changes is that the penalty is from month to month, when we know, in fact, that basically every generator, for the most part, is going on forced outage for some percentage. Thankfully, it's typically very low, but, we expect that to occur at some point during the year, but then now we've set up this penalty structure where they're going to get penalized sort of no matter what, even if they're around the norm.
Well, no, remember, there's the dead band around, I think what you're calling the norm. And I'm
the month?
Within the month, it's 2% above or below the, I think, what is it? I'm going to get the numbers. 96.5.
Okay.
Yeah, 96.5 is quote-unquote norm, and then there's a 2% dead band above and below that, whereby if you're 2% above that, you're a little more available than what we would hope, but you're not, way more available. You're not eligible for the payments. But if you're a little under that, you're not subject to them either.
Okay. So, again, don't want to belabor the point about the RAME, but on the DR and non-generator resources, I think we would be more interested in something that was more focused on potential, which is more equivalent to traditional generators and less focused on last year's performance, which we think is already incentivized through the RAME
okay. And
not through capacity counting.
Right, thanks. Chris, you want to add something?
Yeah, so I just wanted to touch on what we were thinking about when we were discussing the DR and that non-NGR storage. And so, and Carl is taking the lead on some of this counting rule stuff, so he can add on to this. But we realize that it's kind of hard to do testing on some of those kind of resources, so we were thinking we would want to go with that registered capacity value. So those resources have the ability to tell the ISO what they believe that they're worth. So that's not actually saying you have to look at historical output of that resource. That is not the proposal. It's actually that resource owner would say our DR program is worth 100 megawatts. And so since we give them the flexibility to actually state what they believe their capacity value is, we need to have some incentive for them not to overinflate that. And we think that that the RAME incentive mechanism, that is more, I would say, better fit towards some of these other more conventional things that we're doing. But the idea behind this counting aspect of it was that we would just do a verification, I think we were calling it an audit, of the actual dispatch of those resources so that we don't have to test a DR resource, and we're still able to accept their capacity value, but they're not just free to, give us whatever value they want. We still want to be able to ensure that we can reliably count on those kind of programs, that they will actually provide what they're saying. So that was the thinking behind that, and that's why there's a little bit of a difference here, and actually I believe that there's a good reason why we have that potential for future penalty on that particular type, because it is a registered capacity value where that allowed to tell the ISO what they believe it's worth.
Yeah.
Sorry, are we
go ahead,
do we not have slides on that later? Are we skipping?
We are not talking additionally about our accounting rules here today.
Okay. So sorry, I was not.
But you can
bringing
you,
it
you
up.
are allowed to bring up that which we have presented in the past for discussion again today. There's no prohibition on that.
So in reviewing others' comments, I agreed with a variety of other stakeholders on that point. And, you know, not to belabor this too much, but to my earlier comments, I mean, we've been discussing this in the RA proceeding at the CPUC. We just had a decision in June that talked about load impact protocols as a way to evaluate the RA value for demand response resources, which is, I guess, a similar concept to looking at performance. But one of the things that struck me most about this four-hour assessment, if you were to look at actual dispatches, others in the room or on the phone could correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's very rare that demand response resources are getting dispatched for 4 hours. So that's not going to be a very good test because they're often only dispatched for an hour or two at a time. So again, you know, we just had a decision saying load impact protocols. We didn't say that was final, but we've given it a lot of thought and discussion. And I think as the DR programs mature, which they're still somewhat nascent as a capacity RA program product, you know, the rules need to mature along with them probably.
So this is Chris. So I would just remind you that there is also under that counting methodology the idea that the ISO would still reserve the right to you know, dispatch that resource and actually test the resource. So the idea was that we were trying to maintain as much flexibility to not call on these, I would say that, you know, more of a limited resource where you're not trying to, you know, call on DR in the beginning of the year when, to, you know, to establish a capacity value when it might be a program where you might be worried about, you know, the oversaturating the use of that. So I think the idea was if the ISO had the ability to do that test, if they hadn't seen an actual dispatch over that duration of time where we could do an audit and see if it actually met its registered capacity value, later on in the year when we were past maybe some of that peak time frame, I think we would issue a dispatch and actually, you know, try to do that kind of a verification. At least that was the discussion we had internally with our operators and the folks that do that kind of validation and verification testing. So we did have that idea of having that test in place and still have the ability to do it, but that we would use it in a very limited and sparing manner. If you know.
To clarify that point, though, again, to the extent that a DR resource has been shown in a given month as an RA resource, again, there's the opportunity to ensure, and again, you know, in as we move forward, you know, we're looking at DR as I think it's maybe an opportunity for us to start thinking about what DR of the future looks like. Is it still going to be something that's dispatched for 1 hour three times a month, or is it something that, you know, as we start moving other resources off the grid, we start to see more retirements, it's something that is dispatched a bit more frequently. So, again, to the extent that tests are necessary, only under the auspice that the resource isn't actually dispatched. So if the resource is dispatched, that audit, we have the after-the-fact audit that's eligible. If it's not, and there's questions about whether it's not able to perform up to its registered value or not, if it's shown in an RA month, it's a resource the ISO is relying upon, and so therefore eligible to be tested.
You missed our CCE3 workshop 2 weeks ago, Carl. You could have spent all day talking about this with us.
I'm really glad I was in North Carolina at that time, but thank you. It was much nicer on the beach. I'm sure it was invigorating and captivating, but nonetheless, again, that's, I guess I'll leave it. We appreciate the feedback. So, Nora?
Thanks, Nora Sheriff Klika. I just want to compare and contrast Chris's statement that the testing would be used in a sparing and limited manner
mm-hmm.
with your assertion at the last working group meeting that there could be a test every month.
I don't see how those are incompatible.
Twelve
times a year is, I would assert, not frequent if it's shown every month.
I would disagree.
So I think that the key here is that the ISO would reserve the right to test the resource in the month that it was actually shown for RA. That does not mean that we would do that every time, and we understand that these resources are, again, as I said, we don't want to oversaturate the dispatch of these resources and you know, impact the actual availability of how much we could call on them. So I think that we're trying to be flexible here, and I definitely understand your concern, but the idea that we talked about with our folks that do that kind of testing and stuff was that, you know, if we would try to rely on the validation of an actual dispatch as much as possible, and that kind of a, you know, look back and audit of the dispatch information. But if we didn't see that happening, at some point during the year, we want to issue a dispatch for them to do that test.
And I'd like to emphasize one of Chris's points there is, again, there is a distinction between may and shall. Again, I don't think, you know, if we think that the resource is reasonably available and capable, I mean, we don't have to issue a test in every given month it's shown. It is a may optionality. And, again, I think Chris's point on that's very important.
I just want to point out there's a 2014 CPUC decision that states that demand response resources being counted for resource adequacy shall only be subject to one test per year.
Thank you. Paul?
Paul Nelson with Southern California Edison. I share Nora Sheriff's concerns. I mean, kind of a generic rule. I mean, these use limited resources involving DR. I mean, when you call them for a test, there's cost to the person providing that.
Yeah.
And so when you said 12 is not excessive, I'm like,
Well, for a program that's eligible to be called how many times in a month?
I think there needs to be some, you know, thought into, I mean, if you have a reasonable good idea that your last test would work for another month,
And
is there another reason to do another test?
I think that's a very fair point, Paul.
Yeah.
But to Nora's point about, you know, there's a 2014 decision at the PUC on one test per year that was also prior to the 2016 decision that authorized basically what amounts to a registered capacity value where there's not a lot of verification. The load impacts go away more or less for some of these resources. So some of the verification tools are not quite as clear.
The load impact protocols are still used to verify.
I'd like to follow up. I mean, I definitely understand the verification being able to understand that you're going to get the quantity that you want. But there's this balance, and certainly when you talk about demand response and other resources, that there's a cost associated, which could be significant.
Yeah,
and that there's a balance somewhere to be achieved here.
And Paul, I want to be clear that I absolutely agree with that.
Okay.
I mean, we're not looking to unduly burden resources unnecessarily, but again, there's also there should be an opportunity for the ISO to test and verify that the capacity that's being told that we're to rely on and be made available to us is. Again, we don't want to burn through a limited number of uses in a year unnecessarily. If we're looking at the difference of do we think we're going to get a lot more in August or a lot less in August than we got in July based on a test event, that's a fair question. But again, I think we're open to discussing a bit more through the RA County rules component of this discussion what that balance is. We can get a lot of feedback other than we're not sure you quite got it right. And so trying to figure out, I think you're raising exactly the right point, Paul, which is what's the balance to be struck here?
Right.
And so we would appreciate more feedback as we move forward on this on how we determine that. So thank you. No, you were shaking your head earlier.
That's all day, I guess. But I had a couple of points. One is the last RA decision specifically talked about load impact protocol, certainly for IOU only demand response programs, but not third-party controlled programs. And those are essentially registered capacity.
Right, that's good clarification. No,
and that certainly, I think, only goes until 2019 for the time being. But granted, things could change from now to 2019. But second question for the ISO is, you know, within when the ISO wants to test it, I think that there was a proposal from the ISO that said for demand response that it would be accountable under RAME, but then the following year that the registered capacity value would be derated. Is that?
Yeah.
So then
I think that's the point that Meredith was making.
Right. Okay. So yeah. Does that mean that is the ISO considering, and maybe I didn't understand Meredith's point here, that the following year that resource would not be put under a RAME because it's based on historical?
Because it's already been the value has already been derated. I think what we're trying to address on that question, again, we're kind of like, I think we're hitting on a point now that's a good point to hit on that I wish we'd have hit on last working group meeting. So I'm not really set to provide a concrete answer for it, but again, if you guys want to take an opportunity in this next round of comments, we'll welcome that feedback on
on how we might, again, to Paul's point, how we strike the balance for some of these resources to make sure that, A, you know, we're not being unnecessarily harsh, because, again, if they're available, we want them available at the right times. We don't want to test them just for the sake of testing. But, B, that we do have an opportunity to make sure that what they're saying they're offering, they can actually do. So help us understand how to strike that balance. Thank you for bringing that point up, Paul. I really appreciate it. Meredith?
I'm sorry. Since you don't have slides on this specifically, I'll just bring this topic up also. And I'm not sure if others addressed it in their comments. I don't think we did. So you're also proposing for the DR resources and then for storage to use a four-hour assessment time period. And as you know, we've had significant discussion based on requests from parties in our RA proceeding to consider creating something other than a four-hour capacity product for demand response and storage resources. I don't remember what Kaiso's comment was on that proposal.
They're not supportive.
Not supportive. Okay.
My mic turned off, so I want to make sure the people on the phone heard that.
I can't remember what you said in your comment.
What we specifically said was we're not supportive at this time. There's really, our assertion was that there's not adequate record or evidence to demonstrate what any of that benefit would look like.
Which is why it hasn't been in a proposed decision or even a staff proposal yet. But
right now, there's a four-hour requirement on NGR resources for RA at the PUC as well.
That's what I'm saying. So right now, there is a four-hour requirement, but many stakeholders have asked us to develop a record and consider developing potentially a two-hour product. And so just, again, to highlight, if we go forward with that this year and the commission sees that it would be justified to develop a two-hour product, then if you've written this into your tariff as a four-hour assessment, we'll have another point of inconsistency.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions on the phone?
There's no one.
Okay. So, I consider 1 hour to be short, by the way. So with that, I can handle next steps, Tom, if you want, because I'm
sure.
That's really it.
You got a question before you go to next steps?
You had your chance, Alan. You had your chance. I said, are there any other questions? You said I didn't see any others. Go ahead.
All right. I kind of just wanted to ask a question as to how this is going to play out. Potentially, so my question is, you know, is there a RA RAME price that would lead the ISO to not feel the need to include forced outages in the planning reserve?
Ooh, that's a fun question. So is there a price at which RAME penalty could exist where we know that it was such a driving incentive as to say, nobody would ever go on forced outage without providing substitute capacity? I think, wow. You have always got to count. I mean, because I can stand up here and say, yeah, I mean, you can make it really high, but I don't know where that's going to go. Noah, your thought, please.
Yeah, I mean, if you're looking for a counter offer, essentially you can you replace RAME with using all of the offers that are available to the ISO CSP mechanism, which is part of the CPM, where all surplus capacity is bid in or offered into the ISO's market, if you will, instead of using it for CPM purposes, you could use it on a daily basis for substitute capacity.
Fielding comments and questions on that counter proposal. I like this discussion. This is great. Let's keep going. Seriously.
I have a counter proposal.
Well, first off, I want to see if anybody has thoughts or comments on Alan's initial question and Noah's counter proposal comment. Nothing. Alan, your counter.
Something else that PG&E has been thinking about is taking into account how much actual substitution has occurred for forced outages and taking that into account in the planning reserve margin. I mean, since we're going to be doing this stochastic PRM study, the assumptions that we're going to make in terms of what the forced outages are, when they're going to occur, and potentially which resources are going to be taking forced outages. I mean, it depends on how detailed your LOLE study is going to be, but those forced outage assumptions are going to be pretty important. And so I think that's just this conversation has caused us to start thinking about what assumptions we think those should be, and whether the forced outages are going to be substituted or not has a big impact on what your underlying PRM is going to be.
Okay.
Can I ask a question on that?
No.
Please?
Yes.
So for clarification, just for my knowledge, I guess, so when you're doing an LOLE study, you would, you know, take into account those various characteristics of the system and the resource, the force outage rates of individual resources. So, and I guess I'm just not familiar with how that would work. Would that be another input into the study process where we would be saying, having a probabilistic look at how often these are requiring substitution? So we would just have that as another, I would say, you know, variable in that equation. Okay. Yeah. I hadn't thought of that before, but that's kind of interesting. Certainly something to talk about. So.
Yeah, I think that, you know, what I've heard is, you know, two very interesting points that when we come back together on this topic, I may push both Alan and Noah a little bit more to kind of help me expand on some of the ideas so that we can, I think, have a more formal discussion than just kind of throwing some ideas out at the end of a working group and actually have a we got another 2 hours? Well, Nora's already packing up. Okay. Meredith.
Sorry. Perhaps you said this at the very beginning, Carl, but are you the issue paper or whatever it was that was issued in May said that CAISO would be proposing a probabilistic assessment of planning reserve margins. So are you totally backing away from that now and just saying 15%?
No, we're not. That's another working group meeting.
Really?
So this is Chris. So I think Carl put up there, and actually I think, you know, Noah mentioned something about this as well. It's that, you know, we're explaining something of the makeup of what the PRM in our view covers right now, which seems. But the idea is in the probabilistic methodology as well, you would still be covering those same characteristics that are listed up there in this more of a deterministic explanation of what PRM covers. But the study would just be using a reliability criterion that's meant to capture all of those separate individual deterministic looks that we have under this. I hope that helps you understand. And we are planning to continue forward on doing that loss of load expectation-based PRM study.
Okay. Shut off again. Are there any last questions? Is anybody on the phone? Okay. I'm going to try this again. So we are requesting stakeholder comments on this discussion by August 17th. Again, I think we've brought up and touched on some items that we did not expect, so feel free to include in those comments a bit more of the discussion about the demand response resources and finding the balance of the audit / tests and ensuring capacity values for a registered capacity value. We'll include that on the template. Please do use the comments template. It really does help make sure that we're able to address comments and questions across the various stakeholders. We will be posting that on the regional RA webpage, and you can submit those comments to the initiatives comments at CAISO.com. Thank you. So thank you. Have a good day.
And for folks on the phone, this concludes the call. Thank you very much, and we look forward to your comments. Have a good day.